to some of this. In addition, I think the issue with processing the ARRA funds, which was about $654 million, which was about 80% of our existing federal funds, also contributed to that because we had to work those projects as well. But I think there are a number of things coming together, but I think that philosophy shift clearly was the signal that sent us in a different direction.
Sorry, Mr. Keemans. I just want to just, and then I'll come back to Mr. Korzynski. I just want to make a, I mean, the bottom line on this philosophy change, and it's almost impossible to develop a policy to quote-unquote counter this, because the policy would be essentially this. It would be don't treat maintenance and capital improvement projects the same. Don't federalize, treat every project as a federal project. Spend your money, the maintenance money that we allocate.
As a board, then, how do we catch on that something's not being done right? Like, would we catch on when we get the balance? Do we get that report?
You catch on when people start screaming at you that projects that have been approved and have been told are fully funded are not getting done.
Did that happen?
Well, I think.
And then, you know, I'm just trying to look out. We got a lot of new guys on the board, and I'm trying to.
One thing I can look back and see is when the previous commissioner started talking about a dollar doesn't care if it's a maintenance project or a construction project. Looking back now, I mean, I think I could have said, I mean, that should have maybe said, well, why not? Because we have construction and we have maintenance projects. I mean, if we really wanted to think about it, something that might have cued us off.
Yeah, Mr. King.
My question is that on the maintenance funds, you developed this budget by having participation from the districts submitting to you the request for maintenance funds to be spent. Did the maintenance budgets for all the districts come to the $378 million, and we spent all that was budgeted for it, or do we have maintenance budget for the districts that come somewhere close to $529 that we just simply did not let these contracts and we didn't follow through? What is the disparity there in that?
Okay. First, if I could address Ms. Pete's question, we will be trying to bring a different type of financial report to the board that I think will help answer your question about judging where we are in terms of our spending. So I think that will help answer that question. And Ms. Keene, in terms of the budgets for the districts, the districts receive an allocation of money for the year. And the audit identified that the spend plans that the district developed was substantially less than the allocations that they were granted for that year. So from the beginning, we didn't plan to utilize all of the allocations that were awarded. That was in the report. And I went back to the slide to indicate that the third bullet was formalized district budget review process to ensure strategic direction condition assessment are addressed. And the next bullet, monitor plans and budget with the objective of spending available funds. FY10 districts plan to spend $505 million less than what was allocated. I didn't go through and explain each one of those points. But that's where we're talking about some of that philosophy shift. And the key point here is the audit said from a finding and from a recommendation, we need to develop processes that we make certain that we're spending those funds in the year that they were granted. But I also caution that there still probably will be a balance at the end of the year, but it shouldn't be the $529 million.
This is a follow-up to Mr. Peake's
query, and it's really more on responsibilities of this board. The other significant board that I serve on is the Federal Home Loan Bank. And when our regulator comes in, or PwC comes in and does an audit, it is the staff's responsibility to meet the objections and come up with recommendations. But we as a board have a responsibility to see that what the staff is recommending is something that we're behind, or, you know, we kind of interface with staff to make sure that we've met our legal responsibilities as a board. I guess this is a question for council, but where does that, how does that relate now to the CTB? An audit recommends changes, staff comes up with supposed remedies, hopeful remedies, but we as a board, do we just hear about them, or do we interact with staff to make sure we're satisfied that we follow the directions of that audit, or is that responsibility to the secretary? I don't, I'm asking that question as a board member, a new board member.
Well, you correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Worley, but my understanding, and it maybe highlights a little bit of a inconsistency here in what, how this board arose originally, was essentially it was about construction projects and awarding construction projects. And over time, as the program has changed, we now do not just highway construction, but other, obviously rail, and we provide general oversight to the programs. But essentially, this board still is charged with, I'm going to say, administrative oversight of the transportation programs, but actual execution and implementation is really charged in the executive branch.
Yes.
And so, and I will maybe mention that because I think of that way the HITBIS board's history and how it's developed is that we've never really looked at maintenance. I mean, if you look at our maintenance, it's just a line item. And, you know, I think after a few years ago when the major problems occurred in the construction program, a lot of very good work was put in place for construction and monitoring construction projects from the time contracts were let to when they were completed, and with the dashboard involved. This audit really focused on two big areas. One is what was happening in maintenance, because you all, especially those members who have been here before, were transferring money for construction, moving it over to maintenance, and TPF over to the HMOF. And maintenance levels were going down. We're putting more money in, more levels going down. The second thing is obviously project development, which you know, that, I think that process obviously has had major problems in dealing with the issues that were not dealt with previously. And add into that, obviously a major cutback in personnel and the need to change all our processes. So we have general authority, administrative authority, but again, the actual implementation really does rest with Mr. Worley as commissioner and the governor's office as being the chief executive.
And this would be more of a policy board, not supervisory, so
yeah.
The administration of it would rest with me, and I will bring different reports to you on a appropriate basis, whether that's monthly or whether that's quarterly.
Thank you for that clarification. I thought, to me, it was important to know that one way or the other.
And I just want to mention something, Ms. Gordon. I mean, we have to come up with ways to make our program more transparent, okay? Because there is and has been a certain degree of opaqueness in the program and how money's spent, and we should be able to ensure that people do and are able to monitor the money. I mean, even from the governor's office, it's difficult to really keep track of right now the way we keep track of money, particularly.
When we talked about, you know, the maintenance was being treated like construction, the accumulation of funds, and that leads me to understand that these were large maintenance projects, I mean, you wouldn't be accumulating funds over a period of years for a $3 million maintenance
project. Some of those
have a breakdown?
Yeah, some of those would be large projects.
Some are.
Some.
I mean, this is a large chunk of funding here.
Yeah, but you know, when you got nine districts and you multiply 30 million per district or 40 million per district, that comes up quickly to your number. It's a mix of projects.
Mr. Chairman, I totally agree with you in terms of the implementation point that you and the commissioner made, but obviously we're sitting here talking about it for a reason. And the reason is because it's become a problem and it's on our agenda. It's a chart as simple as this is what we're looking at. It shows what is unspent. And I don't know that we need to see detail after detail after detail, but it seemed to me, back to your point of sort of information and being clear, I guess, and being transparent, to use your words, that sort of information coming back to the board would help everybody, help you all to produce those reports and make sure you knew where we are, you knew where you were and we knew where you were. And it is not our job to supervise or so forth or implement. But if we're going to allocate the money, I think we have almost an obvious duty to make sure that it's spent properly. So I would advocate that exactly what you've suggested, that we go down that line. And I do think it's our responsibility, as best I understand it, to at least be aware. And then if it's not being done the way we think it needs to be done, then to set policy that ensures that happens. But to get into it and to do it, obviously, that's not our job.
And it is, and one of the things, this chart, it's helpful but not helpful because obviously it's a snapshot.
Right.
And that's why we have to have monitoring and make people aware. And that's why, by the way, the next chart, I think this is the most, we were up at the House Appropriations Committee on Monday. A lot of questions came about this. And this chart, I think, really is exceptional to make people understand what the problem is on the maintenance, and that is essentially money is building up, and you know, as Snorley points out, that on June 30th, which is halfway through your maintenance year, whatever, or, you know, halfway through that, you should have more contracts out than you have money, because on the July 1st, the next fiscal year starts, and we ended up constantly falling behind. That just led to the buildup of cash. And this chart would be even worse. I mean, this would be, you know, let's just lay this all out. If we had spent $200 million on snow, how much money would we have?
Yeah.
$700 million.
$150 more.
Yeah.
If the budget was $80 and you spent $230?
Yeah, so we'd have, but I mean, we spent over $200 million. And above, how much?
Was the budget.
It's the budget.
We spent $230, so we ate $150 more than we expected.
Yeah, so it would have been worse. This chart would have been even worse.
Okay, project development. The recommendations currently use the same process regardless of size or complexity. Designate certain construction and maintenance project types for state funding only and develop risk-based approach to reduce time and cost, improve communications between districts and central office, develop project management performance metrics, and increase district and central office monitoring, shorten procurement time for obtaining consultant engineers. And these were all recommendations to try to improve the process to move our construction projects to get them out quicker. On the operations related to safety and congestion mitigation, analyze the effects of the reduction in safety service patrol to determine the impact on congestion. The auditors indicated that because we just implemented some of these recommendations, we couldn't really assess the impact of it at this point, so they put that finding in there. Improve connectivity and redundancy between the transportation operations centers, and provide technology funding and better leverage and market available technologies and innovation. Compliance with the blueprint, make business process improvement and design structure and staff size based upon analysis.
They're primarily referencing a continuous improvement process to look at what we've already done, monitor and assess use of contractors and consultants for effective utilization, cost savings, and outsourcing alternatives. Throughout the blueprint, we had they made the comment that they couldn't really determine why we outsourced certain things. And the recommendation was to take another look at that, implement the planning and investment management group in each district. That was a position that was created during the blueprint to bring more focus on to the planning, programming, and planning process in the districts. And we've aligned our central office process to be aligned with the district. Some of the actions underway to address the audit recommendations, we are going to advertise an award over $900 million in maintenance and construction contracts by December 31st, between the period of June and December. This is something that we've already started, so we're trying to escalate that. Advertise an award, 261 projects for
approximately. On that bullet one, is that in all districts, and is it a part of the unused maintenance budget in that district?
It is all districts, and it is a portion of the unused maintenance will be included as well. For the third bullet, develop $450 million in paving and maintenance-related projects to close the gap between allocations and available awarded contracts. We typically would do about $200 million. So we're looking at doing approximately $400 to $450 million this year or this planning cycle. Improve the process of obligating federal funds. We've actually started that process. The staff has been meeting with all the districts to come up with a plan on how we obligate all of our projects. We would like to have that in place on October 1, but we're hopeful to have that done within the next couple of weeks, where we now will know which projects we want to obligate early in the year so that when we look at our maintenance projects, we only obligate those maintenance projects that we need to obligate, not prepare all maintenance projects as though they are federal. We've started conversations with FHWA in terms of getting the $400 million in toll credits approved. Do not anticipate any major issues there. We had used toll credits before, and as soon as we get our database corrected and get them confident in how we're tracking that process, I don't see where that will be anything difficult. We would hopefully add back to the program the $524 million in Federal Reserves, so when we're coming forward in our planning process, we will put that back into the program. Recommend to the CTB that we have anywhere from $60 to $75 million of money dedicated annually to do PE work. We need that in the budget so we can get plans to have projects in the pipeline.
I'm trying to get an idea on the balance side of this. You put $60 million in planning and engineering, what is that going to drive in terms of actual construction, by the time you get into right-of-way procurement, utilities, construction, what's the rest of the cost associated with that 60 on average?
I believe on average we're looking at a 10-to-1 ratio, so we're thinking about $700 million.
So this would basically support the overall construction budget Yes. that we have on an annual basis. Okay.
And then that's, one of the things that came quite clear after Mr. Worley and VDOT finished with stimulus projects was that looking for how to obligate our normal obligation authority from the feds. Mr. Worley and the staff did an outstanding job getting all our money obligated in time by actually ahead of schedule. But you guys have to scramble to get there.
Yes.
So we've got to get this. There's a major problem in the pipeline. The pipeline is broken, and we've got to get the pipeline fixed this money is going to go.
My perception is the stimulus and the way that got structured broke it further. It had to be shovel ready, which meant it all went to those. We didn't get the engineering, so it almost depleted the pipeline of any projects.
If we got, I don't know, would we be able to obligate $500 million in shovel-ready projects today across Commonwealth?
I doubt we have it.
Well, but it's even worse than that. I think we, but there was no pipeline. I mean, it was just, once the stimulus took those projects out, and the projects were already had underway, there really wasn't a pipeline. And they had to scramble. And this is going to cause us, I think, problems in the future as we now federalize. We went looking all over the place for, I went looking all over the place for projects that would be, meet the federal criteria to be federally qualified. And so now we federalize different projects that might not have been federalized previously. Is that true?
That's correct.
Mr. Worley, this is quite a bit of activity over and above what we put out in production. You mentioned the blueprint and the reduction in staff. Do you have the staff and the resources to actually do this?
We will have the staff and the resources to do it. We will have on-call consultants available if we need to assistance in getting these plans ready. We will use on-call consultants. I mean, because I don't have all the staff now to get that done.
Right. But I've noticed the ones you've added back are previous people that we.
Right.
One of the things you've got in here, the audit has, is the problem we had in procuring professional services contractors.
Yes.
7 months, I think. Best case scenario is 7 months, but the IG revealed it could be over a year.
Right.
So we're just going to, are we creating sort of a list that's already pre-selected so that a district administrator can go right out to a, and it takes 30 days rather than?
Yes, we have some of those on-call consultants on staff already procured.
Now,
so we can go to that and get them to do some of the work, and we will have to go do some more procurement. I mean that's, and we'll have to try to shorten that process. Now, my goal is, it's a little bit tricky. I want to start a procurement process early, but I can't really do that until I know what my budget is going to be. So we may look at our program and see what projects we think will be approved and start that procurement process. So that when we get to July 1, we're about ready to go. So we're going to try to get this going early. I'm taking a bit of a risk that the budget will be approved, program will be approved, but I can't afford to keep waiting. I got to move forward.
It looks like we have to adjust the six-year plan to add back in a little over half a billion. When will we pick that up?
We will probably start that planning process. One option is to follow the normal process that we have now. We're just beginning our process of meeting with the MPOs and discussing some of their priorities. And then that will come down to about May, and where you guys will see, the board will see what we have in terms of a program, where staff will be meeting with you. We'll have the hearings during that period. We can wait through that process and then update the program.
Do we need to do it earlier to get this money going?
I would probably rather go through the process, but that's up to the board.
5.4 is not this year's money. I mean, it's throughout the six-year plan.
Right.
So
isn't it already in the plan?
What's that?
I'm confused.
It's not in the plan. It's not in the plan.
The unspent funds that have been allocated, I guess what you're referring to is the $500 million, right?
Right.
And the money's been allocated, but it's not in the plan?
No, you're talking about money that's in the projected revenues that was held in reserve and what
the reserve fees. I got the reserve fees.
It's not allocated identified for programs.
My second question is, are you fairly comfortable that, I guess what I'm thinking is VDOT's got to be the primary obligator or the primary customer for road construction maintenance people in Virginia. And there's a certain capacity of those folks to do a certain amount of work every year. Obviously, we haven't done as much since we held some money back. But if they've got a set
capacity, and we double our money going to them in 1 year, do they have to forget the consultants and the people to get the money out? Is the infrastructure capacity there and the contractors to actually do the work? Is that an issue or is it not an issue?
We posed that question to the contract, to the industry, and they are ready.
They said give us that problem.
Yeah, they said give us that problem.
Well, and most of them have so much latent capacity because they've already done such big layoffs.
Well, most of the capacity is in Hampton Road, so I know we could put a lot down there quickly.
Mr. Kulabank, would you like to respond?
A lot of the PE has been done on projects in Northern Virginia. So
we'll give you $5 million for trails.
But let me just show the last slide if you want, and then basically Mr. Worley is working on an action plan that's going to be presented to me and the governor. A lot of it's going to have to come back to you all, and obviously it's going to mean adding projects either back in or new projects into the six-year plan and other. It also may result in some policy changes as well, recommended policy changes, and new ways for us to monitor the monies so that the board can be assured that that when it votes for projects or for monies going out to various programs, that it is spent in the ways that you intended it to. Because I think all the board members, whether new or old, understand that we don't provide those sorts of reports that allow more tracking and better transparency. And we're going to make sure you get that, and that we put the management controls in that to ensure that this, that what you vote for and support and what the public expects all is actually implemented. Mr. Peacock.
Yeah, on those lines, we all remember last year, I guess, the budget crisis back before that. I mean, we closed down the rest stops. I think there were going to be $16 million, or it was $18 million. And here we had, I assume they're in the maintenance. We're closing down, so we don't have enough money for $16 million in rest stops. And we had $400 or $580 million in the maintenance fund that was unobligated. Similarly, I think grass cutting probably comes under. Just cutting the grass and the medians and things like that, I know we cut that back. Is that under maintenance?
That's under maintenance. There are two categories in the maintenance. One is the services category, and one is the investment in assets.
I don't ever want to be sitting here as a board member be told that we don't have $16 million or whatever the grass maintenance is and have $580 million of unobligated funds. And so I don't know what those reports need to be, but we need to get them because I don't want to come back here and find that out.
We will make certain we have financial reports that will show you where we stand.
Ms. Coleman?
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to say that having been briefed on some of the details of the audit, I think it does provide us a great set of guidelines to move forward. I think it is appropriate to have more aggressive cash management policy. I do think it is, and everyone would support a streamlined process, a better sorting of, call it the routine projects from the more complex ones, and finally that there be some incentives actually for spending money as opposed to carefully holding money back. I do have some questions, and I know that this is probably the time to review all of them, but one of them is the inconsistencies and confusion that can result from your financial management system and your project management system. And I wonder if one of the recommendations that we ought to pursue is also a way to get an enterprise-wide look at operations as opposed to keeping those two systems separate, which just because of time entries and balances, sort of separate and very different looks at what VDOT is doing at the time. Do you have any comments on sort of an integrated approach there that would give you a real snapshot instead of multiple snapshots, which doesn't really necessarily tell you either one is correct?
I do think there are some controls that we need to look at in terms of make certain that the programming process or system is balanced with the financial system and first point is look at it on the front end and make certain that the resources that you approve from the budget perspective definitely is balanced with or agrees with that we start off with in the program. Then the issue is throughout the year is to have a constant check to make certain that those funds stay in balance. And it's easy to get off balance if your systems are not integrated. And they're not integrated at this point. In terms of, when I say integrated, if you make a change in an allocation on your six-year program, does it automatically adjust in your financial system? And the answer is no. So you have to monitor it closely to make certain if there were any transfers or changes in one system that they're also populated in the next system. And I do believe that we need to put some controls in to make certain that that's taking place.
Definitely so. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Commissioner, has there been any consideration within the, for the $561 million to maybe increase the maintenance payments to the localities, and just spread it out, further throughout the Commonwealth, so the localities would benefit from the extra, the monies that were never allocated as well.
Most of those funds that were identified, that carryover funds, were slated for maintenance projects. So it's been allocated, if you will, to a project. We just haven't gotten that project out the door. And our challenge now is to get those projects out the door.
Okay, so everything has really been identified.
Yes.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that, when you look at this money, it's money that's already gone through the system, that essentially went through, was put in the six-year plan or put on, through and actually identified against projects, whether maintenance or construction. It just wasn't actually spent.
Chairman?
Yes,
Mr. Rich. With respect to these additional federal reserves, the $525 billion, it sounds like we're going to deal with that in the normal six-year plan process. What percentage of that would be maintenance and what percentage would be construction? Do we have any idea?
That would probably be pretty much 100% construction, and probably about half of it, I believe, would probably be related to the maybe 50% to the MPO areas. And I'm not certain of that yet, but
there's no formula guiding that, right?
Right.
Okay, so it'd be up to the board as far as allocation.
We have some federal rules that we have to abide by, and right. We will follow those rules in apportioning that amount out to the MPOs.
Okay.
That's only for those monies.
Yeah, only for the amount that relates to the MPO. So when
the overwhelming majority is essentially. The board will have $500 million more to allocate within the six-year plan on construction that are federally qualified projects.
Is that the board or at large or district?
75% for the
federal district. Oh, here's the deal.
Doug, make your speech again, please.
Mr. Karczynski, you're already jaded. It's only like your second board meeting. Oh, no, Mr. Coleman. All right, let's hear it one more time.
Yeah, that does lead to a question. Will those funds be programmed through the normal formula that we use, or will those be possibly, could we set them aside for statewide and regional connectivity priorities, or exactly? They're in the six-year plan now, they're just not programmed.
No, they're not
in the six-year plan.
Okay, they're in our transportation trust fund, but not programmed. I mean, where?
They're reserved.
You just took 10% off the top. So we didn't even act as if it was there.
Yeah. Okay, so that sort of remains to be seen then, exactly how we'll allocate the funds, whether it'll be through a formula or whether it'll be through some other criteria.
There's a lot of partially funded projects in there. So the projects could be identified, just not the funding applied towards them because it was in the reserve. Because we cut a lot of those.
We did. We moved a lot out, actually, off the list. Yeah.
So one of the questions that I heard was, will it go through the formula? And that formula has been suspended. And because we don't have enough revenue to go through the formula, this would not be enough on an annual basis to make that formula work.
And the federal doesn't really go through.
Well, we take all the revenue and estimate it and put it through that formula. But this amount would not be enough to make that formula work.
I think that the commissioner, like Harry Truman, is admitting that the buck stops there. But I think that when you look back at what happened in the past year with the legislative mandated reduction and the implementation of the blueprint, there was total distraction at the central office, total distraction in all of the district offices. I think we pointed out a lot of things that need to be addressed to prevent problems in the future. But frankly, I think we're very fortunate that it wasn't worse than it was this past year.
I'm sorry.
What a question.
Thank you.
He was taking up for you, Mr.
Lloyd. Mr. Lloyd, just to go along with what you're saying, right after we got into office and started going through some of these issues, obviously this audit, and some problems were detected along the way. Mr. Worley and the staff already started to make course corrections. And I think this thing actually could have been worse if they hadn't started making some of these course corrections. And also, I mean, we would have really been facing a major embarrassment if we were not able to obligate all our federal funds this year, which was again, something he identified with the senior staff at the very beginning, right after we took office, and did a lot of work to make that happen. So, I mean, this could have been much worse. I mean, not just because it's the blueprint, to which, you know, I think we're going to still have to go back. Mr. Worley doesn't like it when I have this. I do say this, but we're going to have to go back and take a look at the blueprint at some point to understand some of the decisions that were made, where offices were closed, kept open, whichever. I think we need to have a much better idea about the data and make more informed decisions on some of these issues versus, I think, what was done previously. But the charts show you things were going down a path, not a very good path, but then it went right off the cliff as soon as the blueprint hit. So.
I'm sorry.
Anyone else? Worley, thank you very much.
Yeah, we'd like to cover just a couple things. Part of that, the actions on the way, we have some new staff on board. You met the chief deputy before, Charlie Kilpatrick. You know Rita Busher is handling the programming and planning function. As I talked about, we kind of aligned that with the new position that we have in the field, focused on programming. We've hired a new financial officer. I've asked him to come up, John Lawson. John holds an associate degree in science and arts from Rappahannock Community College. He is holds a bachelor in accounting from Christopher Newport and is a graduate of Virginia Executive Institute. He's worked as an accountant in an engineering firm. Started with VDOT in 1987. He's been our budget director since 2001. And if there's anything you want to know about the numbers, you can ask John.
Thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate that. I just want to say hello to all of you and make sure you are aware that I'm here to provide you with information you need, and I'm glad to work with you and look forward to working with you as we move forward to advance the transportation program.
Suffice to say that cutting through all this, $400 million in toll credits were really funds that were not in the system. The rest of the funds were in the system somewhere, maybe not effectively used or efficiently used, but were in the system.
Well, the Federal Reserve wasn't in the system.
We knew about it, but it wasn't in the system.
Right. Right. So that artificially, but the toll credits, the toll credits, and
I don't understand toll credits.
Keep in mind what toll credits are. It essentially allows us to use 100% federal funded, which then doesn't increase our federal obligation, our federal obligating authority, but it does give us, allows us to free up state money where we have more flexibility. Now, there is going to have to be one of the action items that Mr. Willie is working on is the CPR bonds, the 3202 bonds, right now essentially are geared towards the
matching.
We're going to be asking the General Assembly to give us the flexibility to use them on real capital projects directly.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to introduce Emmett Hetzel. I asked him to come up. Emmett was formerly Assistant Division Administrator in Location and Design, and Emmett will be our new State Maintenance Engineer. He is a graduate of Virginia Military Institute and holds a Master's Degree in Civil Engineering from the University of Virginia. He served for 27 years in the U.S. Army and in the Army Reserve, retiring with the rank of a Lieutenant Colonel. Emmett worked on the private sector engineering firm for 18 years before joining VDOT in 2003.
Obviously, I don't have anything prepared, but I have some sympathy or empathy for Mr. Peek. He's a new board member. I've never been a state maintenance engineer either, so we'll learn together.
You got a lot of money to spend.
I'd also like to introduce our new state construction engineer, Mark Kakamas, is a PE. He's VDOT's new state construction engineer, division administrator for scheduling and contracts division. Mark previously served as VDOT's Hampton Roads district construction engineer since 2005. He has 15 years prior to joining VDOT. He's worked in the construction and engineering firm in Mobile, Alabama. He received his associate degree in forest technology from the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse, New York. He's a bachelor's in civil engineering from the University of South Alabama and a master's in public administration from Old Dominion University. He is a certified professional constructor and a certified construction manager. And he's also a PE.
I look forward to the opportunity of serving the Commonwealth, and any construction-related questions or issues, don't hesitate to call me and I'll find the answer. To do a little patronizing, I've spent more than half my life south of the Mason-Dixon line, but I did grow up on Long Island.
I knew I liked him already.
And he's not here today, but Garrett Moore is a former district administrator in Stanton, will now be the district administrator in NOPA. And I believe he's already started the meeting with people and getting used to the difference between Stanton and Northern Virginia. So, Mr. Secretary, that concludes the presentation.
Mr. Secretary, can I just say one thing before the commissioner leaves? And I really think these reforms that are going to be undertaken will give VDOT a lot of credibility about efficiency and really improve the stature of the agency. One thing I think you heard at the hearing and that I hear from members of the General Assembly and other folks that I think we ought to look at, especially in some of the more rural areas, is over-engineering projects. And we need to maybe look at value engineering if we don't need to spend all this money in some cases. I think that will even add to our stature as being an efficient, lean operation. So if we can somehow look into over-engineering, I think that would be helpful.
Okay. Right sizing.
Yes, sir.
And traffic circles. Don't forget the traffic circles. I
understand.
Swirly, thank you very much. I appreciate the presentation, all your work, and I'd just like to congratulate all the new appointees, and we look forward to working with each of them in their roles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Worley also had asked that we add just a quick presentation, so something that's going to be added to the agenda this afternoon. I have about Adam Zetespik from Transurban.
Good afternoon. Unfortunately, I don't have any presentation slides to offer, but Mr. Secretary and members of the board, my name is Adam Hesketh. I'm here on behalf of Capital Beltway Express and the Capital Beltway Funding Corporation of Virginia, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to say a few words this afternoon about the proposed reissuance of the Capital Beltway bond into non-AMT mode. By way of brief background, the Capital Beltway project, like many other assets and companies, has unfortunately felt the effects of the recent global financial crisis. Interest revenue is lower and interest expenses are materially higher than original expectations. It is very important to note that the financial position of the project is very sound. It is a very healthy financial position with sufficient contingencies and reserves in place. However, notwithstanding that fact, the increase in interest costs have been material and significant. In response to that, and simply in its capacity as a service provider to the project, CBE has been actively monitoring both the status of the project as well as the status of financial markets to look for any opportunities that may exist to increase the cash flow liquidity of the project and or improve the risk profile. We believe we've found an excellent opportunity to do both of those via a reissuance of the current Capital Beltway bonds from AMT mode, where they are subject to the federal government's alternative minimum tax regime, into non-AMT mode, where they are exempt from that regime. That is an opportunity that has been made available by the federal government's Recovery Act, and an opportunity that unfortunately is due to expire at the end of this calendar year, thereby placing some time constraints on our ability to take advantage of it. The reissuance into non-AMC really has the opportunity to present the project with three key benefits. Lower interest costs, an increased demand for the bonds in capital markets, and a reduced risk around any future refinancings if and when the need does arise. So in our opinion, those three benefits are compelling and very much worth pursuing. There are some costs associated with the reissuance. They are predominantly legal fees and reissuance fees. Those costs will be recovered fairly quickly via the interest rate savings available under the non-AMT exemption, or under the AMT exemption. Other than the upfront costs, the ongoing interest rate savings, and the improvement to the risk profile, the impacts to the project are nil. There is really no change to the rest of the project. There is no increase in the debt profile, not even temporary. There is no change to the relationships with the third-party providers and no impact, partners I should say, and no impact on those partners, be it VDOT, TIFIA, or the banks providing the LC over the senior debt. And that's really the key message, is that we're simply going from a position of having senior debt, that is private activity bonds that are subject to AMT, and making them exempt from that AMP and not changing anything else, including especially at the construction or operational aspect of the road. So in short, we see an excellent opportunity here to improve the cash flow at the asset and to improve the risk profile. And as such, we've put forward the draft resolution for the board's consideration. That's it in a nutshell. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
So if I understand to simplify this, you're going to refinance this with different type bonds, which will provide you with a lower interest because of the way they get issued, and that will in turn give you added cash flow for the project?
In a nutshell, yes. In a nutshell. The name of the bonds will be unchanged. They will still be the Capital Beltway, and I won't give you the exact title off the top of my head, but the name of the bonds will be identical. They will have a different CUSIP, which is the means of the number that identifies the bond, so they will be technically different. However, they will be exactly the same in structure. They will have exactly the same LC banks supporting them. The quantum will be exactly the same. It was just as you say, they will be exempt from non-AMP, which really means that the investors who buy them are willing to accept a lower rate because they're not paying tax on interest.
Which is better for...
Which means less interest expense for the project, which means during construction more cash available for construction, and during operations more cash available to run the asset.
How does that translate to the user in the end state? I mean, is it just going to make it a more viable project, or will you have lower tolls? What's the...
It should not impact the operations in any way. The operation decisions should be made autonomously from the debt service requirements. The project should have been and has been structured in such a way that the operational cash flow will substantially support the debt service requirements, but it's really a case of operational cash flow then being used to satisfy debt, not tolls being set in a way that covers that debt.
If I remember right, from the way the agreement was structured, that there's a certain amount of ridership, HOV, three persons that can ride for free up to a certain threshold. I think that's 24%. After that, the state incurs a subsidy to the program because of that cash flow challenge that would present to the company.
Yes.
This reduces your cash flow, but it wouldn't impact the rest of the agreement in any way or this actually increases your cash flow, improves your financial position, but that's not going to translate to the rest of the agreement?
Yes, you're correct, and no, it shouldn't. And an important point that I should also make is, I guess, to reiterate, the project has seen an increase in interest costs far and above what anyone anticipated at financial close. Fortunately, sufficient conservatism was built into the funding structure to place contingencies and reserves in place. This process of reissuing these into non-AMT should improve the cash flow situation, however, not to the extent that would get us back to where we were originally envisaging. I guess what I'm saying is we're playing catch-up, but we're moving all the way back.
Any other questions? This will be up on the new business. Sorry, this came up in the last business request from them. They got a meeting in November, and our November meeting is back to December, so it was either try to get on this agenda, or we have to wait for the very last meeting before they can go forward. This goes out this calendar, right?
I'm sorry?
This opportunity ends this calendar.
That's right, and that's really the reason for the agency, and we're very appreciative of all the flexibility there.
Does that protect them enough time if we vote on this and approve it and to do the transaction in 3 weeks? Or does this have to be authorized by the end of December?
An approval at your December meeting would not give us enough time, unfortunately, to issue prior.
We have to do it today.
We have committed to providing subsequent detail on the financial model, the financial implications, the documents to VDOT. So there will be additional discussions held after this meeting prior to VDOT's endorsement and prior to the reissuance taking place.
Mr. Chairman, quick comment. I think this is an example of how the board is going to have to be more responsive going forward, where we do have these partnership agreements. We are an active partner and investor in this project ourselves, and because they're complex and multi-year, we do need to be able to make these adjustments as we go, and particularly take advantage of where there are some financial positives that come up after original agreements are signed. So thanks very much for bringing this to our attention, and I think we'll have a positive outcome.
Thank you for hearing it, and in the ordinary course of business, we would usually prefer to give you more notice.
Yeah.
Okay. Next item is a presentation by Mr. Tyer on our proposal to establish an infrastructure bank. Mr. Tyer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. About a proposal that we're working on in the Secretary's office to establish a Virginia Transportation Infrastructure Bank. It's no secret that capital is king when it comes to doing construction projects, and that's what we want to talk to you today about is opportunities to generate more capital for construction. I won't read to you everything that's on the slides, but public funds for transportation are limited. Revenues, as you've seen, and because you've been here a lot longer than I have, the dip in the current revenue is now in its third year going down, and it's going to be several years before it can recover to what we became used to in the middle of this decade. Private funding is limited, but there are opportunities to leverage private funding. State is restricted by its debt capacity currently at 5%. There is work being done on that as well. TIFIA is a wonderful program, although it is oversubscribed. There's a small state chartered infrastructure bank that became available to us under a T21 and TLU, but it is a very small volume of activity. I won't read to you everything on the TIFIA slide, but it's important to know that the thing there is it provides low interest rates to big mega projects. And the example that's used on the slide is the Hot Lanes project has a TIFIA loan. We have TIFIA applications for other projects, I-95, 395, Midtown, Dominion Boulevard, all of those. Also, because the TIFIA program works so well for construction projects, it's oversubscribed. Applications exceed available funds. So what we're talking to you about today is the opportunity to establish a Virginia Transportation Infrastructure Bank capitalized solely with non-federal funds, which would be state funds or private investment. Why do it that way? Well, if you're not in the federal TIFIA stream or you're not dealing with federal funds, at least at the capitalization level, it reduces your project costs, it reduces your regulatory compliance issues, so you can move projects to market a little bit faster and a little bit cheaper than the other ways would. This concept that I'm going to talk to you about in the next few minutes of a revolving loan fund is not new to Virginia. Virginia Resources Authority and the Literary Fund use a similar concept. It kind of works like this. You issue low interest loans with maturity of 20 to 30 years. We're not in the business. We're not trying to compete with the private capital markets here. Typical Wall Street deal would be a 20-year financing for a AAA jurisdiction with level principal payments and declining interest on an annual basis in 20 years. We're not trying to get into that market. We're not trying to compete with that market. We're going to make direct loans to the groups that you see there, localities, governmental authorities, railroads, transit companies, private sector companies, and for the sole purpose of constructing and maintaining our transportation infrastructure, both roads, bridges, rails, ports, airports, you name it, we want to look at it. So let's talk a little bit about how it would be funded. This is not set in stone. This is nominal for purposes of this presentation. And you take the proceeds from the privatization of ABC stores. You supplement it with some one-time funds that were identified in the VDOT audit and as a result of process changes that we make going forward. That's kind of your initial capitalization level. You supplement that with private sector investment. It's not going to be on a global program basis. The private sector investment will come on a project-by-project basis. Certainly, there are other opportunities available. Year-end general revenues that are driven by formula, an annual appropriation by the General Assembly would certainly help in keeping the interest rates low. If there was a general fund annual stream of revenues, then that would help to keep the interest rates below market. If you don't have that dedicated revenue stream to help you do below market, then you have to create some kind of reserve to do that. The big deal here is this is a one-time infusion of cash, and it is a self-perpetuating program because the loan payments, you make loans instead of an allocation. The loans get repaid. Those loans, they leverage more funds. They make more loans. Leveraging, I won't go into all of this. Leveraging is kind of the American way. It's a lot of way. A lot of folks have bought houses. You don't have the amount of money that you need to go buy the house. The very first day you need the house, you have a down payment, and then you borrow the money. That increases your upfront capacity. As I said, this is the mortgage example of when demand exceeds your capacity. One of the assumptions we are making about this program is it would make below market interest, below market rate loans, and I will show you an example of how that's saved. We talk about below market. What does that mean? You could do an interest subsidy. You could do a subsidy for a PPTA project. As the previous gentleman talked about, if you partner in a project and it keeps their cost of borrowing down. In the process of making these loans, though, it's important for the bond rating agencies and the folks who are assessing or investing in projects that you keep a diversified loan project, loan portfolio. So you don't want all of your money in one project or two projects. You want to keep it diversified. When I'm talking diversified, I'm talking 20 to 50 active loans that are performing on a regular basis. Again, the concept here is big is leveraging, and we talk about leveraging, we're talking about going to private sector markets. Here's an example. If you had a private activity bond with 7%, it costs $140 million in interest over the course of the project. For every time that you can move that interest rate down by 1%, you save the project $20 million. And you can see the charts are going 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, all the way down in terms of interest. Leveraging kicks in because you have the ability to create this seed capital for the privatization of ABC stores and the sale of that, supplement that with some one-time fund, and now you have a loan portfolio. And a loan portfolio is a revenue stream, and then people will loan you money based on your revenue stream, and that's when you can go out and leverage. You can ask bond investors to invest in your program. We could leverage the initial investment, whatever it is, up to fourfold from the private credit market, depending on the quality of the loans. The higher the quality of loans in our initial portfolio, the more willing bondholders are to invest in the portfolio and to invest in the program. I talk about creditworthiness. I'm talking about if we had a portfolio that was 100% triple B rated debt or better in our initial loan portfolio, then folks would be willing to invest in that. If you start to mix in a lot of toll projects that are not rated or speculative rated and they don't get a credit rating, then your ability to leverage goes down. The important thing to note here, as one of the things I said earlier, is that currently the Commonwealth debt capacity is limited. It's limited because of the pledge of full faith and credit, what we're talking about here. It's taking that revenue stream of loans, pledging it against additional revenue, against additional bonds, not backed by the full faith and credit. So this is a loan program or an infrastructure bank outside of the Commonwealth's existing debt capacity model, and it requires a one-time infusion of cash the way we're talking about it today, and then it's self-perpetuating. The loan program repays it and makes new ones. Yes,
sir. Chairman, so that would mean that it is not subject to our debt ceiling?
Yes, sir.
So it is, operates totally outside?
Correct.
Okay.
So if the leveraging is based on the quality of the loan, the higher the quality of the loan, the more you can leverage, the more you can raise private capital, then a lot of things come into play. the quality of the application, the quality of the project. The higher quality, the better the revenue stream, the higher the rating of the project, the more you're able to leverage that revenue stream. In the process of doing that, as I said before, you don't want all your money tied up in one or two big projects. That's going to limit your ability. You want a minimum of 20 projects that are performing on a regular basis. So that leads you to the application criteria that will improve the quality of the loan portfolio, the feasibility, the creditworthiness, the regional or statewide significance, all the things that we talk about here. We talk about projects. Economic benefits, and we talk about economic benefits, we're talking about not just the economic benefits during the period of construction when there is job creation, but long-term economic benefits. Certainly the availability of dedicated revenue sources. If a locality was to pledge a revenue stream, or a private sector was to pledge a toll stream, or a locality was to do a TIF or a CDA or any of those things that would provide a revenue stream, that's going to enhance the creditworthiness of this. And you can see the list of things that you would be able to do. It's just about everything that this board deals with and our other transportation boards deal with on a monthly basis, construction, maintenance, port, airports.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Trying to get, you said you wouldn't want to do one or two big projects. You'd want 20 other projects to be viable. Can you give us an idea of your definition of big versus viable? I mean, are we talking 20 million dollar projects, 20, $100 million projects?
I would say a large project would be our $400 million contribution to a major PPTA project like a 95-395 or a any of those.
So this would support, if it were properly balanced in the way you've addressed it, $50 million projects.
Right.
$40, $50 million projects, a variety of those.
Okay.
And that's the thing is that we're looking at this, I mean, the genesis of this is that, you know, TIFIA is so critical as a foundation for providing, helping projects move forward. And obviously, TIFIA is oversubscribed, and it's quite obvious, at least in my mind, there's a certain amount of bias where TIFIA loans are being approved for. We have, I'm going to use the example of within Midtown Tunnel, where the TIFIA, having a TIFIA loan or something like it could have a dramatic impact on the toll stream. And so this is how the concept came up originally. But the thing is about the leveraging is that as soon as we go out with our initial portfolio of loans, get those revenues coming back in, that enables us then to go back out with, essentially either almost like issuing revenue bonds. And that revenue coming in then will enable us to leverage it again. And so, if you could take $1 billion and potentially turn it into $2 to $4 billion worth of projects and be completely outside of the issues involving debt service. I mean, the debt capacity is not going to come close.
To answer Mr. Sterling's question, and then specifically using this slide where I say you could increase the capacity fourfold. If you had two big projects, two $400 million projects, that leveraging would only be 2 to 1 because those projects, I'm going to presume from my conversation with you that they are a toll project, and they're probably either going to be speculative rated or not rated. So they're not going to meet our threshold of triple B or better. So that's going to reduce the willingness of other investors because of the risk associated with your existing. So then your leveraging would go to 2 to 1. If you only had one of those loans in there, your leveraging is probably 3 to 1. So the more mega projects you put in there and the lower the credit rating, the less you're leveraging.
If you had like a $50 million project that's backed by the full faith and credit of the locality or other entity that's participant.
Yeah, that's probably going to be a double A1 or something like that for purposes of the lower help rate. Us a lot.
Better multiplier?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, If you projected that you got a $500 million original capitalization from ABC or whatever, and you're able to leverage that 4 to 1, so you got $2 million to loan out. You wouldn't loan the whole $2 billion. You'd obviously keep some in reserve.
Yes, I would have. This model we're talking about today, you would have to keep some of that in reserve.
Right. But so you'd have $1.5 billion to lend out. You had 20 projects. Divide that in $1.5 billion and that would give you $75 million a piece. So if you back to Mr. Sterling's point, you went to a $400 million, or it changes your whole leverage ratio because of your risk.
Right.
And so we could do 20 projects at $75 million. I'm not sure I understood the bit about continuing to roll up the leverage unless you had additional capital.
You make the initial loan out of the initial capitalization, whether it's the VDOT savings or the ABC, and that's not borrowed money.
Right.
But that loan stream, that has a loan stream, future payment of 20 years.
Associated with
right. And then you can take that loan stream and go to the private capital markets and say, loan us money against this loan, this revenue stream. And you can do that, as long as you keep everything in the portfolio BBB or better, you can do that four times over.
Mr. Chairman, these are revenue bonds. What revenues will be pledged to secure them?
Well, it depends on the nature of the project. If this was a loan to a locality, then they would potentially give us a pledge of an existing revenue source, either their one of their ad valorems or one of their other revenue streams. Or they may, for purposes of a specific project, go to something like tax incremental financing or a community development authority to finance, to provide the revenue stream. I started with the most conservative, went to the next risky, and then the riskiest certainly would be if there was a toll project, and that would be the revenue stream that would be pledged.
I'm sorry, Mr. Kulavay, then could be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is very much a step forward in us beginning to understand some of the modern financing tools that actually are available, particularly as we get into complex projects, and particularly as we understand that the traditional collect taxes, have a big pot of money, build stuff out of it, just really, even if we're more ambitious in that regard in the future, it's going to lag, really, the development of our needs. But I think my concern initially, and I don't know how much detail we should get into it, because I'm not sure what the role of the CTB will be in this process. Whether you're keeping us informed, this will be done by legislation, whether we'll have some responsibilities about administering this at some point or auditing it or whatever, I'm not sure. That probably all has to be worked out. But my main concern at this point is, while philosophically what you've laid out is certainly possible, it's what is this fund really intended to do? What is this bank really intended to do? What is its prime purpose? For example, localities or regions or through the PPCA, there are creditworthy projects. There's already ways for them to go to the market to do those projects. What we tend to see is the projects that we might be most involved with from the locality are the ones they cannot finance themselves. In other words, they don't have a revenue stream to support their own bond issuance, so there's other kind of complications. Another thing is, so I'm thinking one of the purposes of the fund may be to attract capital that's now unavailable to us for some reason, that we're not capturing it through the taxing process, we're not capturing it through the normal bonding process, and so forth. What I mean by that is, for example, institutional investors have no appetite for nonprofit or non-taxable bonds, but they would for taxable instruments. You know, that's clearly a place that we don't play now. That's clearly a place, I mean, that's trillions of dollars that's sort of off limits when you use tax-free bonds. And that might be a way, they would be interested in that leveraging, for example, because there is a revenue stream attached to it, and perhaps they purchase those securities if they were issued at a taxable rate. With historically low interest rates at the moment, I mean, we're really, the taxable part of the interest rate isn't the biggest part anymore. I mean, second thing I would say is,
before you turn your page and go to your next sort of question, the CTB's role is one of the sounding board as we're doing today. One, this would advance projects that are in your six-year plan, and as the Secretary said earlier, we're sharing this all in the name of transparency. In terms of attracting capital that's probably not in the market today, you're probably correct. There is probably some idle cash sitting on the sidelines somewhere in this market looking for places to invest, and this would be an opportunity to do this. You're right. The most sophisticated counties, the ones that have been in the transportation business, a few in Northern Virginia and a few in the metropolitan Richmond area that have been in the transportation business,
for 20 plus years and are used to doing underwriters and bond counsel and those kinds of things, yeah, this may not be attractive to them if they're getting 3.15 for a rate and they already have AAA ratings. People who haven't quite ventured into that market yet, this would be a good place for them to test, get a credit, because this would all have to be rated and interest rates set and all that. This would be a good place for them to stick their toe in the water.
I just want to point out, get this up and running, you're looking at, the earliest potentially is July 1st. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the interest rates are. I mean, right now they're historically low. And right now there's capital. But we don't know where things are going to be. And the issue is for us is to come up with a way to provide the foundation, whether it's a mega project, and providing that foundation for there to be whether other money from us, private sector, localities, so that the whole project can move forward, providing an almost an interest subsidy, or finding ways for us. I mean, we're looking at this as just one way to leverage and move projects forward. As we've seen what's happened to I give it almost as tippy as the, it's been a great success, and now it's the victim of its own great success, and that's unavailable.
Well, part of that, Mr. Secretary, is the credit enhancement opportunity that TIFIA gives. It does make a project more creditworthy because you don't necessarily have to cover all expenses right out of the box. There's different ways to structure it and so forth. The second point I wanted to make was, and you hit on it, is through this process, and this is not the only thing we're doing, obviously, you begin to substitute some financial priorities for transportation priorities. In other words, you end up with a portfolio that the market will value but doesn't necessarily match up with, say, a six-year plan set of priorities. So the question is, I don't mean that's good or bad, I just mean the question is how we coordinate those things together to make sure the Commonwealth gets its transportation system built, not just a series of projects that are paying for themselves. And I would want to make sure that we'd be involved in that process in some way. And the final point is, I'd like for us to really think about, if we do get this off the ground, how many different ways we could capitalize it, whether there's an opportunity not just for additional appropriations, but to attract additional investors, because by definition, that portfolio can be more balanced and can be bigger, particularly if it's backing mega projects. You need that balance. But we can only do that if the capital base actually is increased. So those are sort of three of the observations I make off the top. But I'm very pleased that we're considering a more sophisticated approach, because call it the tax and spend, call it the collection and grant process, that's been over for 20 years. So
there are some other things that the commissioner and I are in discussions about, other things that would provide the opportunity for leverage, but we're still in the discussion phases on those. One other thing I want to talk about is a grants component of this. Because not every project would be creditworthy and not every locality or jurisdiction would have the ability to pay, to come up with a revenue stream to pay back a loan, there will be a grant portion of this as well. I was recently at a bridge opening event, and essentially the bridge kept a locality from getting disconnected. If we didn't do something with that bridge, there was going to be a locality that was going to be isolated by a river. And that's the kind of project we're talking about here. They don't have a revenue stream. They don't have a tax base. They can't do a meals tax or an emissions tax. They couldn't do something to come up with the money to pay for that bridge. So this would be an opportunity for localities to do that. The problem with when you do a grant, it doesn't put any money back into the revolving nature of the program. So we'd have to limit them either by number or dollar value on an annual basis. The important thing is here that they'd have to be regional and locally significant, as the bridge I just described, and they'd have to provide some kind of economic benefit just beyond the job creation during construction. It's not going to be enough just to create jobs during construction. Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Two questions. What other states have done this so we can look at them and see how they've gone? And would the CTB oversee this, or would it have its own bureaucracy? I understand, and how would that
depends on whose money and whose board of directors. If there is just, say, state money, so say there was just transportation trust fund money in it, board of directors is probably going to be made up of some of the folks in this room. If we reach out and pick up ABC monies, then the Secretary of Finance and Treasury and other cabinet secretaries are going to, and the governor will insist on having members on the board of directors. And if we go out one more tier and we attract private sector investment, then a bond rating agency or a financial advisor or all of the above are going to need to be on the board of directors. So it depends on how much it grows and how much it leverages.
But it's not a way to keep, just a way to, I mean, we're developing a proposal on different options for the governor to consider in his submission to the General Assembly. And so, as Mr. Tyer mentioned, the more broader we make this and the more we want to potentially leverage it, the more, quote unquote, elaborate we're going to have the management structure. But I do want to just point out one thing to make sure folks do understand, is that this is about financing projects that would be essentially our main focus was in the six-year plan, but it's going to be beyond that. I mean, we're going to make this available to airports, to things that are beyond the purview of the CTB. So the CTB, you'll have a role in the establishing the six-year plan priorities and the projects and all that. This will be separate from that, and this will be then potentially providing a funding source to maybe projects in that six-year plan. But the CTB itself, outside of highway and rail selection projects, will not directly be involved in the oversight of this bank. Mm-hmm.
To answer your second question, North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas have something similar. I don't know that I would necessarily characterize those as transportation infrastructure banks, but I can certainly get you that information, and then we can make an assumption or a decision for ourselves whether they parallel what we're trying to do here or not.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm still having a little issue with the model, and that is what the vision of this will be. Is it to, you mentioned other outside investors, is it to make money or is it to fund transportation projects?
Fund transportation
projects. Yeah, okay, so that being the case, otherwise we'd want to charge more based on the risk we charge. So
we are doing this, what we're proposing is just for no other reason, and the whole focus is get projects moving.
Right. So, okay.
Leverage the dollars that we have, and you know, be a little bit more inventive in our in the way we do things, because
right. Okay, well, that makes sense. Yeah. I got
we don't want to make money. I mean, every dollar we make will go right back into financing more projects.
As Mr. Coulomb said earlier, there's already a private Wall Street, Water Street market out there doing the traditional stuff. We're trying to advance the program for those folks who can't.
We're not just really looking to get paid for a lot of our risk because we're trying to enhance dollars.
Yeah. And again, you know, this is a project down in your area, a Midtown Tunnel. I'm looking at TIFIA and I see that if they had a TIFIA loan, it would dramatically lower the toll amount because that would essentially subsidize the, that could be our, quote unquote, subsidy to the project. And that's, then we get our project and we get lower rates and we have provided a base foundation of money to help the project move forward.
The Secretary, a specific question. Have you discussed yet would the bank provide, for example, loan guarantees as well as loans? As a credit enhancement for
you? Yeah. Potentially.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Potentially.
Yeah.
Would the bank take an active equity position in itself or simply program, for example, subordinated debt in a project, or would it leave that to sort of other parts of the system?
It could be either. They could ask us to take our debt and make it subordinate to theirs, or they might take a subordinate debt. As I said earlier, the investment in this program will not be at the global. It will, the private sector investment, either on an equity basis or on a loan basis, will be on a project-by-project basis.
Between now, Mr. Secretary, and the General Assembly session, you will actually be rounding out this proposal with all these questions.
Yes.
And developing essentially the framework legislatively to allow us to potentially go in different directions, whatever makes the most sense. And again, we want to a certain extent, as Mr. Tyer indicated, the
range of activities this bank could engage in. It would, you know, we want to have some flexibility to respond to what we see the problems are in the market at that time, whether it's higher interest rates, lower interest rates, whether it's just availability of equity, and so that we can respond. Again, the main thing is leveraging our dollars to get projects going.
Mr. Secretary,
yeah, I'm sorry.
I think some people are having trouble hearing, so maybe if you pull your mic closer when you do talk, because I know they've turned up the volume now. But still, some people are having trouble hearing. So I'm wondering if the books are hiding the microphones. Thank you.
Okay, I guess I've got to turn my mic back on. Mr. Ellis.
Secretary, are there any caps or minimums on the grant programs, or is that to be established as we go along in the establishing the program? Maybe like funding caps, you know, like a maximum amount of funding that could be obtained through the grant.
From a project basis, probably not. From managing the program, yeah, as I indicated on the slide, they'd have to be limited in the amount of dollars that they took out of the program in any given year.
Okay. Is there a percentage, perhaps, that you may come up with? You know, that one project can't go over, you know, 5% or 3% of the overall budget.
I'm still talking to financial advisors, but I'm guessing that the grant portion, 10%, 15% max on any given basis in terms of dollars. And then again, in terms of managing a portfolio of projects, you need active projects paying on some sort of basis or predictability of payment. So we want to keep the number of those grants low as well on an annual basis.
I've already talked about all the benefits as we've gone through, so are there any more questions?
Okay, Mr. Tyre, thank you very much. If anyone has any additional thoughts on this, we'd be more than welcome. Rail update, Director Drake.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, members of the board. First, Tri-Transit Week was September 20th through the 24th. Just wanted to tell you that we had almost 2,000 pledges of people to Tri-Transit during that week. Barbara Parker of Norfolk was the winner of our grand prize, which was 2 Amtrak Virginia round-trip tickets and a free transit pass for the year. So Mrs. Parker has chosen Hampton Roads Transit for that free pass. City of Woodbridge in Prince William County won the local pledge contest for the year. For this is third year in the row now, 16% of the pledges came from Woodbridge. You actually will see more activities from DRPT in increasing awareness and thus additional use of our many transportation choices that are available in Virginia. So just to give you a good note on what took place with Transit Week. Last month's CTB meeting, you had a very detailed rail update by our Chief of Rail, Kevin Page. But there were several of those items that we thought you would need some additional information on this month as things moved forward. First, with Amtrak Virginia, we have negotiated our first-year contract for the Lynchburg train. So that's been finalized. That service actually has run in the black. We still have one more month to collect revenues and ridership numbers on that train. But you'll be very pleased to hear we think that this is the most successful state-sponsored train service in the nation and one of the very, very few that is running in the black for right now. Our ridership year-to-date is at 116,382, which is 128% above over our goal. And, again, we have another month that we can go. Revenues, just under $6 million, and that is 127.9% of our goal. So the good news is that we have completed the first-year contract, very close to finalizing the second-year contract with Amtrak. Our Richmond service, remember, didn't start until July 20th. It's currently at 83% of goal in ridership and 60% of goal in revenue, but again, it's only been running for 3 months. It is our 7 a.m. service out of Richmond, so if you have the opportunity to ride the train north, please take the 7 a.m. It is a very congested corridor, very competitive corridor, and we have hourly service from Richmond between 5 and 9 a.m. But if you take the 7, that will help us with our revenue numbers. We are continuing to work on the feasibility study and funding requirements for the bus bridge between Roanoke and Kemper Street Station to serve the Lynchburg Amtrak Virginia service. That report is due to the General Assembly by December 31st of this year. And on October 27th, next week, DRPT will be participating in a town hall meeting in Roanoke with Senator John Edwards about those various issues. Just to give you another piece of good information, VRE had their record ridership day on October 13th, set their all-time ridership high of 19,322 riders. All top 10 ridership days that VRE has been in 2010. Five of them since Keolis has assumed operation, and they are currently running at 86.4% on-time performance, up from 63% in July and 82% in August. So we're really proud of the work that they're doing. Our Rail Advisory Board did meet last week. We had updates, of course, from Norfolk Southern, CSX, VRE, and DRPT, so just a very informative meeting. To bring you up to date on our Army trains, VRE has approved the sale of 3 locomotives and 10 rail cars to the Army for their shuttle service that will go from Fort Lee to Fort A.P. Hill. So hopefully right after the first of the year, that's a service that will begin to serve those military members between the two bases. In regards to our high-speed rail planning, we have completed public comment period on our Southeast Corridor, which is Richmond Main Street Station to Raleigh, and work is in progress now to address those public comments and submit the final document to FRA for their record of decision. We are finalizing the draft of the Richmond to Norfolk service and hope to get that submitted certainly before the end of the year to FRA for the record of decision on that project. As Kevin told you last month, we did submit 2 applications to FRA on their new money. This is the 80-20 money. It was a total of $57 million between the two projects. One was a second level of environmental study for Richmond Main Street Station to Washington, D.C., and the other was preliminary engineering on the Appomattox River Bridge. We are waiting very impatiently. During the month of October, we're supposed to hear. We thought we would have already heard and think we will hear probably before the end of this week. Announcements have just been made on the Tiger II grants that were applied for. Virginia has only received one of those, and that is the Hull Street corridor here in the Richmond area. Neither Norfolk Southern or CSX received their Tiger II grants for the Crescent or for the National Gateway. So that's very disappointing. We are continuing to work.
So how much money did
Well, what I think it was, you used the number, $100,000 for the Hull Street Corridor project, unfortunately. I'd have to go look at my BlackBerry. I don't. Of course, oversubscribed again, a lot of applications for a limited amount of money. I think we really thought that our two Class 1 railroads would receive something.
Who was the winner? Who got
San Francisco?
Go through and look.
Illinois and Delaware.
San Francisco.
But the stimulus award that we did get, our $75 million up in the Stafford and Prince William counties area, we are continuing our discussions with FRA for that 11.4-mile track, the $75 million project. And actually today, the American Association of Railroads and FRA are meeting, trying to put some of the agreements in place on performance measures. And it's very difficult for Virginia on that because we're looking at how do we craft performance measures for an 11.4-mile stretch in a 110-mile corridor. So that's been what some of our, as Kevin was explaining last time, that we'd like to see those 19 projects built out before those performance measures come into play because we don't know how you measure on such a very small stretch of it. There was a public informational meeting in Norfolk this month, earlier in the month, very well attended again, and it was an update on where we are with our conventional speed service into Norfolk, and just very high excitement. And tomorrow there will be a demonstration ride from Norfolk Harbor Park to near the Petersburg area and then back again to Harbor Park. All three of our CTB members from Hampton Roads are going to be on that train and looking forward to that. We're also moving in our agreements, both with Norfolk Southern and with Amtrak, for that Norfolk service. So those are goals for this fall, to get both of those completed. And we are almost finished with our Senate Joint 63, Senator Yvonne Miller's study on rail operating funds. So hopefully that will be coming to you very soon. Again, we have two state-sponsored service, Lynchburg service and our Richmond service, that we currently are responsible for operating funds. And then in 2013, the four Amtrak regional trains that will become the responsibility of Virginia. So that was a big topic when Kevin spoke last month. Also, Kevin has been selected nationally to be one of four state representatives to be working on the PREA 209. So Kevin will be right in the middle of those discussions. We're very, very proud of him. I'm really glad he's in the middle of those discussions working with Amtrak, representing the state side as well. So those discussions are ongoing, and remember that does not kick in until 2013. We are getting very close, we think, and the median rail line transfer, DRPT, VDOT, the Port Authority and the Office of the Attorney General have been working on the Commonwealth Railway, finalizing those agreements, and for VDOT to receive those 4 miles of track that's been abandoned through Churchland. And once this is complete, the 14 at-grade rail crossings in Churchland will be removed. Also, to give you another piece of good news, and we're very proud of Kevin Page in this, is he has been selected to receive Amtrak's 2010 President Service and Safety Award for State Partnership. So that's a national award. He'll actually be going up November 3rd to be honored in a ceremony in Washington, D.C. So, Mr. Secretary, glad to give you some good news and to give you an update, but many of our things remain ongoing.
Excellent, Director.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? And congratulations, Mr. Page.
Mr. Chairman, might be an appropriate time for me to make a comment, and as probably most of you know, there is a recommendation out there for the elimination of the Rail Advisory Board, at which point I would comment that it, to me, is a very valuable tool for the BRPT and the department to have some forum to promote the department's work and the transportation and to do the recommendations to this board on the selection of projects that we're going to put public funds into private operations. It gives a level of vetting of those projects and applications for the grants that in turn are reviewed by the Rail Advisory Board. And it brings forth the department to give the justification for the best, an explanation of the model, and a determination by utilizing that model that, in fact, we have a justifiable investment there. And we also bring the railroads in, and they give their justification for the investment, also explaining how we're improving the benefit to the public for the state of Virginia. So just as one, it may not be the best to speak because I represent this board on that board, I think it's a very valuable tool for the DRPT, and I'll let them speak for themselves, that in fact we should maintain the Rail Advisory Board as a recommendation.
Mr. Miller?
The $100,000, the big $100,000 that we got.
By the way, I looked it up. They awarded $600 million worth of grants today, and Virginia's share was $100,000.
Is that purely an administrative function, or does Congress have to approve that, or how does that work?
Discretionary funds issued by the
executive branch?
Yes, at the federal, yes.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
What about the Lynchburg train? And I know, Mr. Keene, is there anything going on with trying to get that extended? And know Roanoke's doing the bus, but to get it extended to Roanoke and Bristol and down through.
Mr. Peek, it is part of our state rail plan for into the future, but the bus service, when that study is complete, that would show ridership, that would show demand, and that would show for the expenditure to get it to Roanoke, if, whether that would be a wise investment. So it's really a first step.
There always has been a question on the ridership all the way to the Bristol station. And the studies show that there's such a variable in the estimates on that ridership through the years that with the model they've used to collect that information. So it's not a reliable information we have at this point. And what she's talking about is a test that will give us some help.
And just to go back to the one point that Ms. Drake, Director Drake, made, this whole issue of next year about the potential for us having to pick up all the costs
in 2013 of those four contracts.
But, I mean, we're going to have to deal with it in our fiscal year. So it has some mechanism starting July 1st.
Yes, we do, because we have our state-sponsored trains as well.
Yeah, so to be able to continue any of the services in the state that are considered regional.
Thank you.
Our next presentation is the Hampton Roads TPO. Mr. Palmer?
Chairman, we're going to have Mayor Sessions, chairman of the TPO, introduce our delegation here today. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you all for allowing us the time to be up here today. I would like to let you know, I, along with Mayor Molly Ward from Hampton, who's vice chair of the TPO, Mayor Frame from Norfolk, and Mayor Alan Krasnoff from Chesapeake are in attendance with me, along with Jeff Keever, with the Port Authority, and Delegate Glenn Oder, who also serves on our organization. We really appreciate the opportunity to address the CTB to provide you with an overview of the region's transportation system, as well as our current and projected needs and challenges. First, I want to say I'm very grateful to the great assistance that Thelma Drake has given Hampton Roads in working to make higher-speed rail a reality. It was good just to hear your report. In addition, I want to thank Secretary Connaughton and Board Member Aubrey Lane for all the extra work you all did to make sure that we got the right-of-way purchase for the Virginia Beach Light Rail. We're very excited about that. We are a region of 1.8 million people, split two-thirds and one-third between the South Side and the Peninsula. We have over 1 million workers. Hampton Roads is home to 85 military and federal facilities comprised of 104,000 military men and women in uniform, plus an additional 47,300 federal civilians. The impact of these jobs is that 45% of our economy is based on DOD spending, or over $21 billion in direct spending. The total Virginia economic activity produced or facilitated by the fiscal year 2009 Virginia Port Authority operations were revenues of $41.1 billion, with Virginia employee compensation of $13.5 billion to 343,000 employees. This economic activity generates state and local income, sales, and real property taxes amounting to an estimated $1.2 billion, plus other government fees and taxes. In 2009, the VPA facilities handled 14.9 million short tons of freight, or 1.8 million TEUs. Additionally, 31.8 million short tons of coal loadings occurred in the region.
The port handles cargo to and from every continent in the world. We are the third largest port on the East Coast and are staged to move to number two and eventually number one. In addition, the region is home to some of the nation's top tourist attractions. As you know, the concentration of business and their employees, defense facilities, and associated industries and tourists produced enormous amounts of traffic and congestion. Our assets of the Chesapeake Bay and the numerous rivers and harbors require expensive transportation crossing. They are also the sites of severe congestion. Each day, our bridges and tunnels back up for many miles, some typically 6 to 8 miles each way, which produces travel speeds well below 10 miles per hour during rush hour. Average travel speeds have fallen to 25 miles per hour along many of our interstates during rush hour. The Midtown Tunnel, for instance, is the most congested two-lane road in the Commonwealth. This congestion not only stifles productivity, it also threatens to take Virginia's business to other states. It reduces our competitiveness for new industries, maintaining existing industries, and threatens our defense job base, which is 45% of the region's economy. We know it's now affecting our economy by directly affecting tourism and negatively impacting our ability to grow the state's economy. Many of our bridges and tunnels are now 50 to 70 years old. Two have been torn down and not replaced due to insufficient revenue to maintain them. This is unprecedented in the great Commonwealth of Virginia. To familiarize you with our region, we will have a 10-minute slide presentation. It contains recent Google Earth shots of our major activity centers as well as our major regional corridors. I think once you have seen these facilities, you will agree Hampton Roads, as well as Virginia, has some of the nation's toughest transportation challenges. Please try to look at our needs as a system of transportation improvements. The region has been pursuing these projects as such. It makes little sense to improve the ability to cross Hampton Roads from the south side to the peninsula if I-64 West to I-295 is not also improved. The same is true for Route 460 if I-64 in Chesapeake is not improved. Also, we believe most of our major projects are good candidates for PPTA. At a minimum, we need to finish environmental studies to put as many of these as possible into a posture to be examined by the private sector. One of the issues we want to stress today is the HRTPO is developing a prioritization tool. We have four mayors that have traveled up here today to let you know we are working together and we are going to come up with our priorities. This tool, which we will use in the development of the 2034 plan, will be, we believe, a model for the entire nation. This will allow the TPO, the CTV, and the General Assembly to make very informed decisions on transportation funding. One more item, if I may, before closing. I would respectfully request that Hampton Roads be given very serious consideration in the allocations of funds found through the recent VDOT audits. We have statewide priorities here that need to be addressed. In addition, I'd like to take a moment now, if I could, invite Mayor Frame to make a few comments, please.
Paul. Thank you. Well, Mr. Secretary, members of the board, I'm Paul Frame. I'm mayor of the city of Norfolk, and I am a member of the Hampton Roads Transportation Planning Organization. I know you've had a long day, but Will has already said it well, and I'll try to be brief. For more than 2 years now, the regional transportation and process in Hampton Roads has been undergoing a transformation. The TPO strongly believes that we need a modern transportation planning process that offers our regional leaders the opportunity to discuss and make objective decisions about transportation issues that we know best. We are very concerned about how and how many transportation dollars get allocated to Hampton Roads because our transportation needs are so critical. They're critical to the lives of our citizens, critical to commerce in the Commonwealth, and to our national security. Nearly 20% of the state's GDP is generated by the Hampton Roads region, second only to Northern Virginia. Hampton Roads is home to the Port of Virginia, as you know. We are home to the world's largest naval base. We are home to the largest concentration of military assets in the world and the center of a thriving private sector. In a region that is so significant to the state's economy, clearly, and as Will mentioned, we need additional resources. We are in acute need for them. Especially so, given the fact that we are a region that relies on extensive infrastructure, like bridges and tunnels that are required by our unique geography. And we are a region whose arteries service heavy equipment, like vehicles from the Port of Virginia, or the various branches of the military. And we are a region that will rely heavily on the overburdened infrastructure to evacuate in the case of disaster, which will be problematic at best. Facing ever-growing congestion and unmet transportation needs and constantly and continually dwindling transportation dollars, the leaders of the TPO have strengthened partnerships with the port. We're glad to be joined by Jeff Kiever here today from the Port Authority, the military with our higher educational institutions, as well as the private sector. Together, we are united in our support for the principle of regional prioritization of transportation projects, as the mayor just mentioned. And we have also reached out to our General Assembly delegation. We have four members of the General Assembly now appointed to our TPO, and Delegate Oder, who is here with us today, is one of those members. Also, we have significantly ramped up our public outreach and communication efforts. The old HRTA, the Hampton Roads Transportation Authority legislation that went away because of constitutional issues, eliminated some funding sources that we thought we might have available to us. And so we find ourselves without the funding needed to support even the most critical transportation needs in our region, even with your good work. We have made significant and successful efforts to align our localities with the transportation process. And we believe that even greater outreach and coordination with the Commonwealth Transportation Board is essential going forward. Today's meeting, we hope, should be viewed as only the first step toward an enhanced partnership with the CTB. The Hampton Roads Transportation Planning Organization is currently in the process of formally shifting its monthly meetings, its meeting date, away from the third Wednesday. In fact, we had a meeting this morning before we came up here. We're going to move from Wednesday to Thursday to avoid conflicting with the CTB's regularly scheduled meetings, and we hope this allows for more flexibility and participation in each level of the transportation process, and we will invite our region CTB representatives to participate in the TPO process to the maximum extent that their schedules will allow. And we look forward to an ongoing and productive dialogue with the CTB. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Mayor Kraslow from Chesapeake would like to take a couple of minutes.
Thank you, Mayor. Appreciate that, sir, very much. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I want to express my appreciation to Secretary Connaughton and the board for the opportunity to talk about our community needs. As you doubtless know, our corner of Virginia has always been one of the Commonwealth's economic engines. Hampton Roads is the home of the largest concentration of military might in the world. We have become a major player as one of the East Coast ports of choice, and we have demonstrated our ability to attract international firms to our shores. In the process, we have also created jobs for Virginians who live not just in Hampton Roads, but across the state. A truck stop in Harrisonburg is open because a tractor trailer left the terminal in Portsmouth bound for Pennsylvania or Ohio and needs fuel or servicing, or because one is leaving Dublin on its way to a port in Hampton Roads with a shipment from Phoenix. A railroad worker in Roanoke went to work this morning because coal mined in southwest Virginia needs to get from there to a loading facility in Newport News. Obviously, the importance of a vibrant transportation network isn't limited just to those who drive trucks or service them, or those who dig coal or run a train. As we have seen, whole communities have grown and continue to thrive because Virginians had the foresight to build and maintain a vibrant transportation network. And yet we in Chesapeake are acutely aware that as the vitality of that network declines, So does the opportunity to attract international businesses to our region, much less keep them, for these companies, by their very natures, get how the failure to build a better road in Southeast Virginia can impact the ability to meet a delivery deadline for a business in Iowa. And so I speak to you today, not as a mayor, but as a concerned citizen of Hampton Roads. I speak to you as one who understands that we cannot stand at the crossroads, for that is behind us. Instead, I know, as do many here today, that we are facing an emerging economic emergency that will spare few and, in hindsight, impress many with its swiftness. For my part, I do not want Hampton Roads to become a collection of economic gulags that may share common borders but little else. For my part, I do not want our region, much less our Commonwealth, to see even one opportunity, for economic advancement slip away. To avoid these fates, I want you to know that I am here totally, fully aware that money is short, but I also am aware that you know that our Commonwealth's future should not be decided by whose voice is loudest or whose community has more clout. Instead, I appreciate the dilemma this board confronts, which is how to match, obviously, compelling needs with diminished resources. In that respect, Hampton Roads is but one piece of a very large puzzle. You have been challenged to finish, and I do not envy you sitting in Solomon's seat. I suggest to begin thinking about new funding mechanisms to replace outdated ways of paying for our transportation system. I am encouraged from what I just heard about the transportation infrastructure infrastructure bank, and the grants. And encourage this body will continue thinking about new mechanisms to allocate whatever might be generated in the future. I would also suggest that this is not a new problem. These are the words of a Virginia governor. What Hampton Roads needs is more and more traffic supported by a united Virginia sentiment. The governor was Harry Flood Byrd, and the year was 1928. But his words are no less valid today than they were then. We are in this together, and I urge you to continue looking for that united Virginia sentiment. Do that. Help us build something that benefits not just a few, but a united Virginia, working together for a vibrant future. Do that, build a new program for progress, and you will have the thanks of a Commonwealth and our thanks. Thank you for your time. Appreciate all of you for your service. God bless.
Mr. Mayor, thank you very much.
The Secretary will conclude with Dwight, our Executive Director.
Thank you, sir.
I'm going to try to do this, Mr. Chairman, in less than 10 minutes indicated. So let me write you this through. What I'm going to do is give you a tour of Hampton Roads and then talk about the choke points. Talk a little bit about the prioritization process. You've already heard about that. And then a quick run through on our major transportation projects. This is our little corner of Virginia from a Google satellite shot. This is just to simply show you the 16 localities, 10 cities, and 6 counties, and again, 1.7 to 1.8 million people. This is an automated slide here. This is taking you to the Oceana Naval Air Station in Virginia Beach. This is along the ocean front in Virginia Beach. This is the Norfolk Naval Shipyard in the city of Portsmouth. This is downtown Norfolk to the right. This is the Portsmouth Marine Terminal. This is what we know as B-Mask up in the Churchland area. This is Craney Island. This is a new ATM terminal. This is Lambert's Point, where all the coal comes in on the Norfolk side. This is Norfolk International Terminal. This is the Norfolk Naval Station, Naval Operating Base. This is the Newport News Marine Terminal, just on the north side of the James River now. It's the Hampton Coliseum, many of you see as an icon as you enter Hampton Roads. This is the new city center for the city of Newport News, in western Newport News. And this is Busch Gardens to our extreme west. And Colonial Williamsburg. That's our introduction for you for Hampton Roads. We have a number of military facilities. When you combine them with the federal facilities, we literally cover the map of Hampton Roads. I believe there are close to 100 in the entire region of Hampton Roads. I'm going to skip this because Mr. Kiever here with the Port Authority is going to talk about this. These are the choke points in Hampton Roads. I'm going to take this clockwise from the 12 o'clock position. I'm going to start with the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel. A lot of you know of it as being a notoriously backed up facility. It carries 90 to 100,000. Let me say this. Let me switch off here, and if you look at the a downtown tunnel, that's in the 2 or 3 o'clock position. A lot of folks don't know that the downtown tunnel actually, 12 months a year, in the same number of lanes, carries more traffic, slightly more traffic than the HRBT in 4 lanes. But they're both incredibly oversaturated, well beyond their design capacity. There's also the Midtown Tunnel right across, just upriver, downriver from the downtown tunnel. There's the 64-264 interchange. Almost 400,000 cars a day go through that interchange. Next, the 5 o'clock position is the I-64 high-rise bridge. Carries 85,000 a day, a bit more than its design capacity. Typically, traffic backs up in the morning all the way back to, if you go to the 6:30 or 7 o'clock position, you'll see the Bowers Hill interchange. Every morning, the traffic backs up to that Bowers Hill interchange. Just below that I-64 high-rise bridge, there's also in Mayor Krasnov's city of Chesapeake, the Dominion Boulevard steel bridge, a two-lane facility that connects literally 14 lanes of interstate traffic to 4 lanes on 17 going to North Carolina. So it's a two-lane choke point with a drawbridge. We come back to I still look at the Monitor Merrimack is relatively new from 1992, the Monitor Merrimack Bridge Tunnel. It's now over 60,000 cars a day, so we're closing in on its capacity. The I-64 Jefferson Avenue is really the squeeze or choke point where 64 goes from 4 lanes with an HOV lane down to 2 lanes in each direction, and then we finish with I-64 at Port Eustis. Literally every day there's an incident because of the traffic levels, and the backups are enormous there. Some of my mayors have talked about the 2034 long-range plan. We're now in the beginning of the fourth year of a four-year update process. We're looking at 155 candidate projects that have price tags right at $30 billion. VDOT's estimate to us for the next 20 years is $2 billion. So you can imagine the challenge we're faced with. We're trying to prioritize it. We do have a prioritization process. It is a series of three mathematical models. We've been working on that with VDOT's consultant for the last year. We have what we call three legs, so that's dual, three different mathematical models. Project utility, do we solve transportation problems? Project viability, is it financially feasible? And economic vitality, does it bring economic gain to the region and to the Commonwealth? And we do this by category. We do not compete all projects against one another. So we have highways, bridges and tunnels, transit, intermodal, systems management, and bicycle and pedestrian. This is a picture of the candidate projects, high priority projects, in no particular order because we have not unveiled our prioritization output yet. But we have the Midtown Tunnel and Martin Luther King Freeway Extension, which you're all very familiar with. Dominion Boulevard, I just mentioned, the third crossing, which we've been working on for a very long time, congestion at HRBT, I-64 widening on the peninsula all the way to 295 here in Richmond, 64 widening on the south side at that high-rise bridge out to Bowers Hill, 460 really all the way to Petersburg and 295, and the Hampton Roads passenger rail service that Director Drake has briefed you on. The Midtown Tunnel, two lanes, in excess of 40,000 vehicles a day, terribly congested morning and afternoon. Dominion Boulevard, again, two lanes sandwiched between Interstate 64, 464, and four lanes going to North Carolina. The third crossing is really a series of projects. Mayor Frame and I have discussed this often. We're still amazed at how few people really know what the content of the third crossing is here, but it's five or six projects, and hopefully we're about to embark on the light blue, which is the intermodal connector that will help Mr. Kiever out in the operations at NIT. It's a $5 billion-plus project. If we're looking at all segments, but we can get started with about $2 billion. Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel, we're looking at, under the current study from VDOT, looking at the feasibility of widening from four to six or eight lanes, and the price tag on that widening, we had at $3.3 billion. The private sector proposal says it's between $3.5 and $4.5 billion. Peninsula widening is from four lanes to six or eight lanes, and again, as I mentioned earlier, all the way to 295 in Richmond. Now, the south side widening, again, the high-rise bridge is located in Chesapeake. We're looking at 460 corridor improvements, again, all the way to 295, and folks have a study underway on that with an estimated cost of $2.5 billion. And the Southeastern Parkway, which we have been working on since 1984, we're still looking at some significant environmental challenges there and a price tag of $2.5 billion. Director Drake has already, I think, talked to you about, this is their slide, hers and Kevin's slide, showing the high airspeed on 460 and the enhanced Amtrak service along the peninsula in the 64 corridor. This is what our fixed guideway transit plan looks like now. We are embarked on, with DRPT as a lead, a transit vision plan for Hampton Roads. Mayor Frame has bitten the bullet and taken the lead on what we call the cutting or bleeding edge of this, but I think it's going to be an incredible asset for this region, working on the first minimal operable segment of the Tide Light Rail system. This is what it will look like when it's finished. I wanted to end with a slide here. Mayor Krasnoff asked me to make sure I mentioned maintenance. These are two bridges in Hampton Roads, the Kings Highway Bridge on the right and the Jordan Bridge on the left. We have neither of those bridges today. VDOT had to have them tore down and simply walk away from that infrastructure investment from 70 or 80 years ago. So that's just a tip of the iceberg of our maintenance needs. And I'll wrap it up with that. Thank you very much.
Mr. Farmer, thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Secretary and members of the board. I'm Jeff Kiever with the Virginia Port Authority. I'm delighted to be here. Mr. Miller, it's nice to see you on this board. Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to be very brief. I want to take a little bit of time and talk about how things are coming together for the Port of Virginia. And despite the downturn in the economic situation, I think the stakes, the stars are aligning for the Port of Virginia, and the opportunities for the Commonwealth of Virginia are simply abundant going forward. You've heard Mayor Sessoms talk about the impact the Port has. Over 340,000 jobs. That's one in every nine resident member of the workforce is employed in the port industry. And you can see the total revenue of over $41 billion. This was a study done by the College of William & Mary for the year 2006. despite the downturn. We do expect business to triple over the next 30 years. The container international business typically grows at twice the gross domestic product, and you can see the trend line here of TEUs, which are 20-foot equivalent units above the U.S. GDP over this historical data. These are population centers that can be served from the Port of Virginia, and they show you the volumes based on the size of the circle. And looking out to the year 2050, those population centers can easily be served by the Virginia Port Authority, and there comes the growth that we talk about. Virginia is a gateway port, centrally located on the East Coast with access, as was said earlier, to all continents on the globe with a full global marketing team. We have excellent Class 1 rail service into the hinterland. Just last month, the Heartland Corridor opened up, and we missed you, Mr. Secretary, at the celebration earlier this week, but Director Drake participated in that as well. And it shaves off 250 miles from here to Chicago, penetrating the heartland of America. And then the National Gateway is a project that was mentioned earlier by Director Drake that would provide additional capacity going to the Midwest. And then the Crescent Corridor is a north-south, north-southern project that connects the port to other inland destinations. And then finally, for the future, is the Craney Island Marine Terminal that would ultimately generate throughout the Commonwealth an additional 54,000 jobs and does have a $6 billion national benefit ratio associated with that. One of the big things that's going to happen in the next several years, 2015, is the expansion of the Panama Canal to allow for much larger ships to call at the East Coast. We're the only port on the East Coast that can accommodate these larger ships. We've been prepared for that, and those ships are coming. When that is completed, it will give Virginia a greater opportunity, and these larger ships will carry much more freight, and a single stop at one location is a potential opportunity for them. Going forward, these are the lowest cost areas that we could serve because of the inland destinations. We already have some of these larger ships calling at the port. This is the CMA Figaro that called here earlier this year. It's 17 containers across. Only 13 containers across fit through the canal today. It's larger than a Nimitz aircraft carrier, and we're the only port on the East Coast that can accommodate vessels of this size. Ships are coming online that will carry 12,000 and 15,000 TEUs. This one carries 8,500. But we can handle those ships today. We just recently leased the APMT marine terminal from a subsidiary of Maersk in July. This added significant capacity to the port complex in Virginia. This is the most modern marine terminal in the Western Hemisphere with a very significant robotics and computer set up through this. Very low labor cost through this, and gave us an additional million TEU capacity, and we can expand this. So we have the capability. Despite the downturn in the economy and international trade, by the year somewhere between 2020 and 2026, we will need additional capacity, and construction we hope to begin on Craney Island a little later this year on the foundation of it, because it will take 8 to 10 years to actually construct the land before we can begin building the first phase of it. But that's the long-term future of the Port of Virginia. That's where all of these things are sort of lining up. With these efficiencies and opportunities that are in front of us, the shippers are very, very concerned with getting their product to market. It's a total cost and very time-sensitive cargo. And as a result of these things, I think you've heard the need and have heard from some of the other presenters today about what those are. But the cargo will find other more effective ways to get there if there are delays. But the opportunities for us going forward are extremely bright, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Not very often that we get to question a member of the General Assembly.
I didn't know I'd come for questions, Secretary.
Get the Bible on. I want to put them under oath.
I'd be more than happy to take any questions. Listen, I did want to come and say it was important to drive up here this afternoon and tell you that I think that the TPO in Hampton Roads has been a model and a leader in terms of corrective actions that have been taken to bring our TPO into kind of the modern era of organizing our priorities and addressing our projects. One of the things they've done is we've added the four members of the legislature, as already been mentioned, to the Transportation Planning Organization. It has been met with a resounding success. It has not been without the travail that comes of having new members on the board. And sometimes it's you can certainly see, and the citizens have commented, that the discussions and interchange between the members of the TPO and the legislators on there has added a lot to our discussion. We've actually gone to the trouble, as a legislator now, I've gone to the trouble of actually encouraging other TPOs across the state to do that as well. I think that this is the model that brings us all together and makes a connection between what needs to happen in the legislature and what needs to happen with our roads. But I will say that the prioritization process that the TPO has undertaken to try and prioritize our projects is going to be a great benefit to the Commonwealth Transportation Board as you go forward and consider how we can address these urgent needs in Hampton Roads. So, and I'll be glad to take any questions, Mr. Secretary, either today or at some other time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roeder.
Mr. Secretary, we conclude, and we thank you all very much for your time. Be glad to answer any questions if there should be any.
Appreciate that, Mr. Mayor. Actually, I want to start with Mr. Kiever. Did we get you up here for a moment? And I just want to make a point, and then I'd like to just ask you a couple questions about your prioritization project. Could you go back to the one slide that showed about the job impacts? Is there a way for him to get that back up?
The jobs?
The job impacts in Virginia.
You're hard.
Yeah, that's right.
The slide said how many jobs in Virginia are tied to the...
343,000, if I remember correctly.
And that's one out of every nine jobs?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And one of the things I just want to just highlight for everyone who's not familiar with the port is that, I mean, right now, obviously, we're concerned looking generally at what's happening with the military. I mean, we started today with BRAC, and then there's the potential for, you know, further downsizing in the military. And obviously, there's the potential for downsizing of the federal government. So right now, this port, and what happens down there is responsible for one out of every nine jobs in the Commonwealth. And it's going to become even more important to our economy in the future as we look at. And I don't know, did you have a slide as to where you'd like to be, what the potential is for TEUs?
No, sir, I did not. We're currently the third largest port on the East Coast of the United States. It's our goal, and I think the opportunity exists for us to quickly become the second largest port on the East Coast and soon to overtake New York and become the dominant port on the East Coast. Now, I wish I also had a slide that showed the distribution centers and warehouses that are all across the Commonwealth that represent these 343, because the preponderance of these jobs are not in the Hampton Roads area. The majority are in the Charlottesville-Richmond slice of the pie, so to speak. But they're within certainly a day's drive. The key component here going forward is these larger ships come online. It's going to be more freight on those ships and fewer port calls. And the ability to penetrate into further destinations from the East Coast, the preponderance of the population is east of the Mississippi. We're within 24 hours of two-thirds of the U.S. population. So if we can continue to attract distribution and warehousing, such as the Walmarts and the Targets that are already here, we think these job creation is a step going forward.
And right now, the port handles just a little bit below 2 million?
Yes, sir.
And the goal is to get to 5 million?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to make sure everyone is sensitive to the fact that, all right, so this is a major job generator today. We anticipate that it will become an even bigger job generator in the future. We want to see the throughput of the port increase by 150%.
Mm-hmm.
And we see people saying TEUs, those are 70% of those TEUs currently moved by truck. And we've got to deal with some of these transportation problems. Now, we have our regular, I want to say, commuter issues that we're going to have to deal with. But if we want to see this major job generator grow even further and really take advantage of the investment we've been making in the port itself. It really means, obviously, we've got to deal in a very dramatic way with some of these transportation challenges down there, or we will not be able to see this growth. And because the citizens down there, just obviously, like we've seen in other places in the country, I always use L.A. Long Beach as an example. They, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, they made the decision to become the largest port complex in the United States. Now they're having a very difficult time expanding because now the growth, they are the largest port complex in the U.S., but now the trucks and all the other congestion and environmental issues are there, and people don't want to see the ports expand, even though they are one of the largest jobs. I think it's one out of every seven jobs in the L.A. basin are somewhere linked to transportation related to that port. We've got to deal with these issues.
You're absolutely correct, but I'd like to make one point further, that complex in L.A., their cargo base is typically consumed there, as opposed to what we're trying to do is to push it out where it is further.
And the jobs generated, you know, I'm sound like a salesman for this, but I think the last numbers I saw of transportation are, where is the Bible? I want to get him under oath. Now I'll ask him a bunch of questions about what happens in the General Assembly, what really happens in delegate order. But I think it's the average job, transportation job, is over $70,000, well above your normal, I'm going to call it, job out there. Again, great jobs, well-paying. This port has impacts across the Commonwealth, and we've got to deal with all these bottlenecks that Mr. Palmer showed are bottlenecks that deal with our citizens and our workers and obviously our ability to make that port grow. So, yes.
I was just going to say, Mr. Keeber, I know Dr. Cookman at Old Dominion University just came out with his analysis of the region, and one thing he pointed out about Savannah was that they had so much more infrastructure for roads, and how the state was supporting that port. I mean, obviously, for us to reach your goals, we've got to step up what we're doing for you.
Absolutely. Of course, the way that port is set up is a little further out from the city than the way our facilities are established. But make no mistake about it, in 86, the Commonwealth recognized the need for our port to grow and prosper and carved out 4.2% of the transportation trust fund for us to reinvest into our facilities, and that's sort of caused us that. But going forward, absolutely, yes, sir.
Mr. Savannah, let's follow up. Savannah cannot handle the larger ships from the Panama Canal.
No, sir. They're at 42 feet, and they have a problem with the aquifer there. They'll probably get maybe 46. But I don't think they'll ever get to the deep draft.
It's there for the taking if we want to take it.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make, Ms. Kulane, you don't want to say anything about Northern Virginia?
The Dulles Airport is exactly the same situation. If we don't improve the support networks, its capacity can't extend beyond its borders. So right. It's the same set of questions.
Mr. Miller.
Not Mr. Keever's area of responsibility necessarily, but it was mentioned earlier in the presentation. There's another factor that's it's very impactful here. I had a discussion probably a month ago with Admiral Harvey, and the Navy's been clear to us in Hampton Roads. I'm not sure how clear they've been to the rest of the state, but they've been clear to us, and we are the largest military collection in the world. The biggest part of that's the U.S. Navy, with both Oceana and NOB and Naval Air Station, et cetera. And he's been very clear to us. It is a huge issue for him that he is not going to bring any more facilities to the region, and he's looking at cutting facilities for a couple reasons. One, the transportation. Well, he can't get his people in and out. He can't get them in and out in an emergency. He can't get them in and out in a regular day. And so he's sitting in a situation where he's thinking about moving a carrier to Florida, and that's part of it. Part of it's political, but part of it is it's easier to handle in Mayport in terms of infrastructure, in terms of transportation, if they build it. So we've got, you know, the whole military national security issue. Of course, they generate a lot of jobs, and those are pretty good-paying jobs, too, with good benefits. Then we've got the sort of commercial issue, meaning the port and all that, and we're challenged more so than any than most places in the state because of all the water that we have to cross. So we've got a huge problem. I think we all recognize that. The question is, what's the real way to solve it? And one of the things that I hope to do is to advocate, as I did with the governor when he was running for office, Mr. Rutter and his colleagues, something's got to be done, or the people sitting here 20 years from now are going to be paying the piper. And, it's a pay me now, pay me later kind of situation. It's all about money. I get it. But, if we kill the goose that's laying the golden egg, we've lost. We missed our mission.
Yes, Mr. Palmer, or Mr. Mayor Sessoms. So the prioritization process, where are you all, and when will that be done?
I can answer that pretty quickly. We should have our first run at it in November. And so it's been moving along at a steady pace, and I think you saw the way it's being done with the three-legged stool, but we should have some recommendations next month.
Okay.
We're very excited about getting that information. I think we clearly heard from our legislators and from members of the CTB how important it is for Hampton Roads to prioritize what we really want. And that means moving the most people for the dollar. And that's what the result of this will be.
Can I ask, what is going on with the Jordan Bridge? I thought that project had been approved and financed. They have not started it at all? Is that right?
Thank you for bringing that up. We look at it being open come 2011, hopefully by spring, and no later than the summer. It's on schedule, it's on time. We're extremely excited about the situation that has developed. In fact, we thank you all for the speed that it was done. Within a year, that particular project went through all the hoops, through all the different departments to make it happen. So we know things can actually happen in this Commonwealth, and we thank you.
The 2034 long-range plan, I know you said there are $2 billion available for transportation projects. Is that just the state money? Or state money that's been identified?
That is VDOT's estimate of total revenue that VDOT has estimated in the current revenue stream, assuming that revenue stream isn't modified or takes any more notes out.
So I'm looking at Mr. Worley saying, how do they get so much money?
We were doing good.
I'm sorry, but how much money do you all, and all localities, but obviously have pretty robust transportation programs? How much of these
localities themselves, local money?
Yeah, I'm just saying, because right now you say 155 candidate projects. Are they all state projects, or?
They're all within what we call the regionally significant definition.
Right.
So they would be federal, state, / local projects.
Okay.
Yeah. On what we call the regional network. Yeah.
Yes, Ms. Cooley.
Thank you. I have a question. The resource that we have at the Modeling and Simulation Center,
yes,
gives us a potentially a new tool to help set priorities as well as understand the network effects. Have you all used dynamic modeling there of these various projects against one another to see if you can build, say, half of them, which of them are supporting half? Is that actually helping drive your project?
We actually, they are a new dimension. We have a static model that we've been using internally for a number of years. I've got a number of staff people that are adept at using that. Dr. Katak and VMask do, as you mentioned, dynamic modeling. They simulate so that we can communicate. I think I told them the best value for their efforts are to demonstrate what it looks like. So they can show backups that are recurring from incidents and that sort of thing. So it's been incredibly valuable. General Assembly has used it on a number of occasions. So it's definitely a brand new dimension, and I highly recommend anyone else contact VMask, and they are capable of using that model anywhere.
Well, the reason I asked, Mr. Chairman, is my day job company is a large one, and we've begun to understand at a much more detailed level exactly where our employees live, where our locations are, and which of those problems we can build out as opposed to build in by understanding
where our own people need to move and so forth. As other companies have done that in Northern Virginia, what begins to emerge is a model of actually what's the priority projects, not what the political priorities are of the various jurisdictions, but here's how you get the most relief for your most important, you know, job segments with this kind of improvement. And it really does change the conversation. I mean, everybody has their wish list, but when you show numbers and are able to say, isn't this economic development too, you know, people begin to sort of look at it a little differently. Yeah, like, well, maybe I can wait on my trolley line.
If you look at slide 10 in my handout, you will see exactly what you said. I have tried to explain it on a number of occasions to the board. I think they get it. That you look at project utility, that model is going to tell you if that project solves problems and it gives you bang for the buck. So there's no political aspect whatsoever to the output of that particular model. If you go to the economic vitality model in there, it will tell you, is it going to create jobs? Is it going to create development? The board will have to set the priorities. This tool will stand on its own. We're going to go through some bumps, but this tool is designed to stand on its own and tell the story.
Well, deep down, Mr. Chairman, I think what we've there's not a member of this board, I don't think, that would question any of the value that you've presented to us today and the importance. The question is our crude mechanism for capturing the value proposition on which investments to make has changed. So we're not just doing general taxes and figuring out build general projects and, you know, sort of the system will emerge anymore. But how to capture the value in a way that lets us see it as an investment decision that we can sustain, that does lead to the benefits that we've suggested, that in turn provides additional revenues to support. It's the way the port itself has had to function. Nobody likes to pay a fee, but if you figure out what the fee is versus the total tonnage versus the value, I mean, that's how you figure these things out. So we're kind of groping toward that model, but without a full buy-in from, you know, the whole policy-making process about what exactly that is. So this kind of guidance helps us understand that that's really the question we're trying to answer. Not can we do 155 projects that cost $30
billion. So. Mr. Chairman, I just would like to add regarding the Virginia Modeling and Simulation Center, that's part of a study that was initiated about 2.5 years ago by Delegate Chris Jones. We call it the Chris Jones Study. But that report is going to take the highest priority projects. It won't be all 155, but it's going to take the highest priority projects. And the report will actually be presented on December the 7th. Will be the final report. It will be a very, very large regional event. We've invited some of the Northern Virginia legislators, like Delegate Jeb May, to come down to it. It's going to be very, very exciting. And they have gone to a higher level than anyone has ever gone to before in terms of actually figuring out where commuters start and where they're trying to end up. They've actually included off-ramps and so forth onto the modeling simulation. It is absolutely mind-boggling what the information they've been able to put into this system. And they're asking a very, very simple question, or they're answering a very, very simple question, and that is, where do you get the biggest bang for your buck? And so while it's not going to be a static model, it's certainly not going to be as in-depth on the other issues as what the TPO is doing. But I do think that the two presentations together are going to give us an enormous amount of information and a great point of discussion for our regional leaders to decide how we want to go forward with our transportation projects.
And, you know, obviously there's been a very big push in Northern Virginia to do the same sort of thing. And I think after we see the results of this, see how we can try to translate this into and do it up in Northern Virginia as well.
Any other questions?
Chairman, yes, I just have a real quick one for the port. Can you tell me what percentage of the port's business is connected to the inland port in Front Royal? Is that a major thing?
Yes, sir. The inland port opened in 1989, and as a result, it has created in excess of 7,000 jobs up there and in excess of $750 million of private investment, distribution, warehousing. Home Depot is up there, Red Bull, Toray Plastics, just to name a few off the top of my head. We move about 60,000 to 70,000 units a year through that facility. It's a direct daily train service from our facilities to Front Royal.
What percentage of the port's business would that be, would you think?
it's not as large. It's not. But, I mean, it has been a huge economic development tool for the northern part of the valley.
Yes.
We continue to see that grow and that model. In retrospect, I wish we had purchased a lot more property up there and made it a much larger facility.
Do you administer that, or is that's a separate?
Our operating company, we own it, and our operating company operates the facility. We market it globally. It's been a great success.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Excellent. Any other questions? Mr. Mayor, Mr. Mayor, Mr. Mayor, Ms. Mayor, and Mr. Jones, and Mr. Kiefer, thank you all for being here.
And Delegate Odor, thank you very much. Appreciate you all coming up today.
Thank you.
Excellent presentation.
That concludes our work session. I'm going to gavel that close. Let's pick up right away. Do you want a couple minutes break?
No.
No?
Yeah.
All right, 5 minutes. 5 after 4. We're going to start up.
Yeah, now it was
Thank you. Everyone, take your seats, please. Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to now the official meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I'm going to first take public comments. Anyone like to make any statements about any issue? No? Thank you very much. First item is the minutes of September 15, 2010. Do I have anyone that have any changes to it?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much. Move now to the maintenance division. And that's all. Better not screw up. He's still on probation, right?
He's still on probation?
My wife says I've been on probation for 26 years, Mr. Chairman. So.
You will be to the day you die.
Well, you haven't been suspended yet.
Sorry, Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, we have five items for business. I'm not sure exactly how you would like to take them up. I have the understanding that the board members have the information in front of them. I can speak to any questions that they might have. But I believe these actions are of a very routine nature.
Does anybody want any issues? Want to do it on block?
Move to approve the five in a block.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? That's a pretty good first time out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Starting on a roll. Okay. Local Assistance Division, Mr. Estes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Item 6 is an economic development access project in Frederick County. It's under the bonded concept, and this board approved the first phase for this project back in June, and the county has come back to us for phase 2. Staff is recommending the full allocation of $500,000 unmatched with $150,000 matched. I want to just point out, Mr. Davies, Dr. Davis wasn't here tonight today, but he did send an email that everything with the Stanton District he's fine with. So, do we have a motion?
On his behalf, I'll move approval.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, item 7, start with, I guess, 7A with Augusta County. I guess before I do that, just, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, we hope the board had sent a letter on the revenue sharing program that went out last week. I sent that to you on an email. I think that was something we discussed last month and wanted you to be aware that we sent out the call for letters of intent for next year's program on that. But as far as item 7A is in Augusta County, and 7B would be the same thing in Hanover, where the locality has asked that we move money either from a canceled project or a completed project that was a revenue sharing project to an existing project on their secondary six-year plan. They just don't happen to be revenue sharing projects that are approved by the board. And that's what these two actions are for.
Well, just both of them, since neither are here. Can we have a motion on both?
I don't approve.
I'm sorry, second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you very much.
Item 8, Mr. Chairman, is kind of the last action we're asking the board to consider on the discussion we had last month on the transfer of Columbia Pike in Arlington County from the primary system of state highways to the local road system. And what this does is it follows on with the movement of the allocation of funds from the Northern Virginia District's maintenance budget for the remainder of the year to cover the maintenance payments that we're going to pay Arlington County. So with,
Chairman, Mr. McCarthy's absence, I'll move the approval.
I'm sorry, this one is Arlington.
Arlington. Mr. Chairman, this is a savings to the state, as I understand it, as we adjust the payment to Arlington.
No, I think we're sending them money.
We're sending them money.
It's been moved, isn't it?
It's a zero-sum gain to the state for this budget. Now, of course, the county will testify that they're going to spend more than this in the annual.
Yeah, I'll move its approval.
Okay. You have a second?
Second. Is this in relation to the properties we deeded to them?
Yes, and now we're
Columbia Pike.
So we went from this is the maintenance plan.
We did not have a recorded no vote on that last time.
No, we didn't.
I want to vote no this time just because of the actions that we received back from that towards some of our officials and towards some of our toward this organization.
Well, we have a motion. I'm sorry, was there a second?
Second.
Yes.
Second.
Yes.
All right. All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Okay. Ayes have it. Ms. Estes.
Mr. Chairman, item number 9 is, again, a follow-up to last month's workshop where we had a discussion on the EDA policy on the bonded program and the payback issue on the inability for some localities to bring documented investments to the sites where they provided, where we provided access to the sites. You heard from two county administrators as well last month. This resolution is basically calls into effect a moratorium where we'll be calling bonds for 2 years, the two fiscal years. That's current fiscal year and next fiscal year.
Mr. Martin, can I have a motion?
Approve.
Have a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right away, Mr. Bennett.
Yes, sir. Item number 10 is requesting permission to dispose of four surplus properties. One is in Loudoun County near Ashburn. The second one is in Nottoway County near in Crookdale. The third is in Campbell County just east of Lynchburg. And the fourth is in Scott County near Duffield. Does that answer any questions?
Mr. Drake, sorry. Should we take them individually? You want to take them all at once?
All at once.
All right. Under 10, we have a motion on 10.
Moved.
Second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? 11.
Yes, sir. Item 11 is a limited access control change. As I indicated earlier, we require some for some projects. The city of Portsmouth built a roundabout, changing some interchange ramps, which now require the change in the limited access control lines.
Move approval.
Mr. Chairman, it's about a half an acre on Crawford Street, and simply this is Mr. Ewer, it seems fine, so I'll move approval.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Item 12.
In addition, item 12 is a limited access change. It's in connection with the Dulles Metro Rail Extension Project. as that's a design-build project, certain elements are being developed as the project is being constructed, and this is a group of changes for power stations and other items that require some minor modifications in the limited access location.
I move this approval, Mr. Chairman.
Second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Thank you. Great job. Programming division, Ms. Busher.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, the first item, number 13, would be to add approximately $2,500,000 in projects to the six-year program. The bulk of these projects are safety projects that have that are being allocated out of what we call the balance entry. Those funds have not yet been allocated to projects, so we have I think it's 11 safety projects, an urban project in Fairfax, and three CMAC projects in Herndon. So these are all new projects to the program.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question on that. On the Herndon thing, am I reading this right? We're giving away cars here? We're buying cars and giving away?
This is CMAC funding that goes to the MPO in Northern Virginia for the procurement of hybrid vehicles.
So we have $300,000 worth of automobiles that were. This is. I have a concern about this. I mean, we just heard about the tremendous need in Tidewater in Northern Virginia. And, I mean, we're not the Oprah Winfrey Show. We're not giving away cars. So this is the first I've ever heard of such a thing.
This is congestion mitigation federal funding
yeah.
for the environmental purposes in the MPO. It's their ability to program these monies according to the federal guidelines.
Couldn't we do some improvements on some of the infrastructure other than this?
It's the MPO choice in these particular
programs. Well, I'd like to separate
programs.
It out because I'm not going to vote for giving away cars.
I've kind of, the same thing triggered. I've never seen it used for what appears might be that we're sort of replacing what would be their operational costs on a normal basis. I mean, are these city or municipal vehicles that they're planning to utilize, and so we're just simply... They're using CMAC funds to replace what they otherwise would fund through their own budget?
Yes.
Now, if they want to do a turn lane or something that makes sense to alleviate air pollution or something like this, but I'm just not going to vote with the budget the way we have right now.
I'm not sure we
the needs in Northern Virginia, what we just heard in Hampton Roads, I'm not going to associate my name with giving away $300,000 in cars. As I say, this is not the Oprah Winfrey Show.
Mr. Coleman?
I understand the substantive concerns about the use of the money, but I think we need a clarification about the CTB's role here. In fact, these are federal funds that are designated for certain purposes, whether we like it or not. These are monies that are actually programmed by the MPO, whether we like it or not, and there's basically nothing we can do about it. Now, I realize that's a difficult thing to say, but part of our responsibility is to carry out the law and the programs that are put before us. So if we want to question this expenditure, we certainly can do so. But we can't do it through this process. And we can't actually not approve what the MPO has decided to do. We can only take affirmative action.
That's
a pretty interesting box to be in.
Mr. Schooler, you raise an interesting point, but can we confirm that the MPOs are all following the federal laws when they do this? I mean, there's some reports out there that they may not be quite understanding what the federal law tells them they can and can't do with these fundings. And I've never heard of buying vehicles with CMAC, not this type of vehicle. I've certainly heard them buy, for bus services and things of that nature. But that's rapid transit. This looks to me like a municipality is upgrading its own fleet of vehicles instead of using its operational budget like it should. It's dipping into CMAC funds, which should be used for
Right. There are other ways they could use this money within the federal government.
we have approved this kind of purchase previously.
Yeah, I don't disagree with my colleagues on the uses of money. I mean, we certainly can do that ourselves to see what the best way to use our funds is. Our funds are, but the problem is at this stage that discussion's already been concluded, and what we're presented with here is a decision by the MPO. The MPO actually is granted monies directly through federal programs, not through us. It's simply as an authorization mechanism we have to actually authorize.
I make a motion to send this back to the MPO with a recommendation that they find a better way to use this for CMAQ purposes.
Well, okay, I'm sorry. Why don't we do this? Everything else other than that, you're okay with?
Yeah, sure.
So if you're making a motion to approve the resolution with the exception of the three items, regarding the county merger, and ask for further explanation.
I will.
Okay. And that's the motion. The motion is to approve, all these projects, with the exception of the three in Herndon, and that the three from Herndon were asking for further explanation and to ensure compliance with.
Okay. Yeah.
Substitute motion.
Yeah.
Well, no, he hasn't made the. He's making the motion. The main motion
was made.
I accept his friendly amendment.
No. You made. No one.
Somebody made a motion.
You're making the motion.
Yeah. That's the motion he's making. No substitute.
He didn't accept.
I make the motion. This is a secretary outline.
I'll second.
Okay.
Discussion.
Yes, Mr. Garzinski.
I just want to. Further clarification that if we find that the MPO is acting within its authority and it is federal funds and they're following the procedure that's already has a precedent, then are the funds then released if we find that to be true with the motion?
I'm not going to
have to come back.
We'd
have
to
come back.
I just send vote on the motion, but then I have a question. It's not going to change my vote on this motion, so I'll ask my question after we vote.
Sure. Okay. Can all those Ms. Coleman? What's that?
Can I speak for the motion?
Yes.
You know, I would ask my colleagues to think carefully about this. Actually go into the MPO project selection process in a much more deep way. Each time we actually have the submissions from the MPOs, definitely, as the Secretary has suggested since he's been Secretary, we should have greater collaboration between the MPOs and this body in choosing priorities and setting priorities and so forth. And I think the briefings we've gotten from the MPOs over these meetings have helped us understand that they're faced also with constraints and difficulties and setting priorities and so forth. But I think it's a dangerous precedent for us to begin to go into the MPO decisions piecemeal and attempt to second guess what they put together. You know, that isn't the problem that's facing Virginia, is that MPOs might be buying a hybrid vehicle when maybe I have a different priority. The problem is there's not enough resources to go around in this process. Also, the framework in which they're working. If this was a hybrid bus, why wouldn't we question that as well? If it was a turn lane we didn't really like, as some people don't like, say, on Route 7 in Northern Virginia, we could second guess that one too. But it opens up a big can of worms in my mind. I think our job is not to second guess MPOs, it's to set priorities clearly and to help provide for the resources that are necessary to build the networks in Virginia. And understanding that a partner in that process actually are the localities, are the cities and towns, are the regional planning associations and bodies. So I would urge you to vote against this motion.
Would the gentleman yield for a minute?
I would urge you to vote against this motion simply because it opens up a huge can of worms and it doesn't actually get at the root of the problem, which is inadequate revenues.
If we're going to have to talk about second guessing, this is the same MPO that's second guessing us on Route 66, on the Beltway, the same MPO that says, I think we give, $100 million to Metro. They don't want the Commonwealth to even sit on the MPO, and yet they want this money. It's a two-way street here. I think if we're going to put our names on something, I wouldn't want, if the general public knew with the budget problems we're having, we're putting money into this, I think they would pay us.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Mr. Coulier, we're 3-4 weeks, a month ago, I might have agreed that, yes, the CMPO's role, but an issue came up within a Federal Highways audit where an MPO may not be exactly complying with federal law, and the response coming out of the MPO was, well, VDOT approved it, and VDOT's being blamed for approving it, us approving these things. So I think that we need to make sure that the law is being followed. When we see something that it caused me to scratch my head because I haven't seen it before, and it doesn't seem to comply with everything I've heard in terms of the use of CMAQ funds, I don't think it's unreasonable to ask for a legal clarification of whether or not they're doing it appropriately. This may not be a legally appropriate use of CMAQ funds. It may be. But I certainly want to know beforehand so that when it takes place, if it isn't legal, that they're not saying, well, that's VDOT's fault for approving it.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask my question? I decided to ask it before we voted. Now, I'm not familiar with this process, but I heard the staff saying offline, and perhaps somebody at the table, that we didn't have a choice. Now, the concept that I have to vote affirmative on something because I don't have a choice leads me to the conclusion that why does it come here to begin with? If we don't have oversight, then I don't understand why it's here to be approved and we can't disapprove. That just makes no sense to me. So I don't know if it's the case whether we have the authority to say no, but if we don't have the authority to bring it in here and waste the time of this discussion, is sort of ridiculous.
Well,
it should be an administrative thing.
Mr. Miller, on the one hand, we don't have this discretion. We are a pass-through when it comes to these funds. And it goes to the MPOs, and they're the ones that decide how the money is spent. However, we generally are responsible for the money. So you want to, so we can't tell them how to spend it, but
can we tell them how to not spend it?
Yeah,
exactly. That's exactly right.
I'm not quite sure. I found that.
I mean, if we can't do either, I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm trying to understand. If we can't do either, then why are we even talking about it?
Oh, I know. Listen, you want to see all the Twitter with me because I end up saying on some federal funds that we're just a pass. They got very upset. They said, no, you're not a pass. You're responsible for those funds. And I said, well, but we can't tell them how to spend it or how to use it or anything. You're still responsible.
I don't know what that means. If I'm responsible, then I get to say yes or no. If I don't get to say yes or no, I'm not responsible. It really doesn't care. I don't care whether somebody wants to pretend I am or not. I'm not.
But if it isn't in compliance, they will throw us under the bus.
We have this situation in the TPO in Hampton Roads. It was brought up earlier in Mr. Worley's presentation about the $130 million on projects that allocated out that nobody looked at or didn't follow up on. The half of that's at Hampton Road. Some of those projects are completed. It's a similar thing. They're pointing fingers at, was it VDOT's fault? Was it the TPO's fault? The whole bit. So from my reading of looking at what we're charged with, it's allocating the resources. And I guess from my point, I think we do have the ability to say no, or we don't understand why this is. And I don't think that is, I think that's in our charter. I really believe that's what we're chartered to do, to allocate.
And I would just add, if it is in our charter, then we do have an obligation to look at it and see, is it responsible to the law, the regulation, and so forth. And if we don't think that it is, then it's incumbent on us to say, we don't think it is. And take, with responsibility goes responsibility. You can't have it both ways. I mean,
let me bring it back.
I don't get you. Thanks.
Responsibility.
But if the MPO, I'll argue on the other side that if the MPO comes back and say, we are in compliance, we're trying to meet the federal mandate of ICE-T on air control in Northern Virginia, which is always a big issue, and this meets it, then what do?
We don't have a choice, then it shouldn't come before this body, period. If it comes before the body to vote on, not for information, but to vote on, then we have a choice by definition.
But there can't, there can't be just one way to meet your CMAQ requirements of buying an automobile. There are many other ways I think the taxpayers could understand. And I'm just not going to put my name on anything like this.
Okay, just call me just go ahead. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No.
The motion is passed with everything except for those items for the town of Herndon. And
we will bring that
back after
certainly.
Could you also bring back a some clarity on what our authority is and what our responsibility is? Because I would vote against the motion if I didn't have the right to vote no. I mean, I would vote against the motion if I didn't have a right to question. Or I would say, why is it coming in here?
It might be also.
I need to understand that.
It might be also helpful for the board members to know what all kinds of alternatives are out there to meet these CMAQ requirements that might make more sense to the taxpayers if you could have, let us just have a list as
sure.
an example. I think it would be quite helpful.
But that does go back to somewhat of a policy discussion to the NPO saying this is what we prefer you do to meet your CMAQ
right, that's true.
Requests. So be prepared for that because you are getting into.
Maybe they'll let us carry forward on 66 and put them in the beltway and let our secretary sit on the MPO.
We'd love all that.
Well, I mean, that brings up a real interesting discussion right now about MPOs. You realize the only region in the state that does not have a Virginia-specific MPO is Northern Virginia, which is causing some issues for us, I think, because it is the Washington region. We can have a separate MPO if there's a desire. But that's another issue. We'll kind of bring this back. So we've got, in addition to this, if you can add at the same time, obviously we've got a couple months, but an explanation about what our role is and what we can do, what we can't do, as well as the general program on RSDP and CMAQ money.
Okay, item number 14.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we must bring back to the CTB 10 transfers between projects in the six-year program that are greater than 10%. And I have a series of those transfers attached. Funding is being moved off of projects where the estimate has come down, perhaps if it's gone out to bid. We've also, for projects closed and their remaining funds, we're moving it to another active project in the program, and these have all been vetted with the district's board members. Yes?
On page 4 and page 5, you got what looks like, if I understand correctly, two reductions of $32 million?
These are, these are the safety.
Yeah, but they look like it's the same. It's the same number. Is that are these two different actions within there, or is that a redundant curve?
There's.
Yeah, it's like this.
We're taking money off of 7,700 and moving it to 81,296. It is 900,000 apparently of one type of money on the UPC and 100,000 of another type of money on that same UPC, both being moved. We're showing it as two lines.
Required allocations.
Two different, there's highway safety, there's primary formula, there's high-risk rural, high-risk state balances. The 900,000 is coming from which one?
So both of these $1 million comes from the balance entry to the 81,296.
No, we know that. Is it in two line items because it's coming from two different sources?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so both are the same UPC, one federal, one state. We're taking money off of each to put it towards
another.
To flee the other one.
I should have done the math. The 100,000 is the match.
Yes.
I have a question. Mine goes from page 9 to page 11. Was there supposed to be a page 10?
Mine goes from 9 to 11 as well. We could be missing a page. Oh.
I have a 10.
Must be a page break issue.
Chairman, move approval of the transfers.
Second.
For any further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much. Administrative Services Commission. Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chairman, we are seeking the board's approval to proceed with sale of the closed Culpeper Residency office and also with the adjacent East area headquarters, East area, East Culpeper area headquarters located right adjacent to the residency office.
Any further discussion?
One question. Sure. As I understand it, the money, this is a VDOT property.
Yes, sir.
But the money doesn't come back to VDOT. It goes to the general fund.
No, sir. That's not my understanding.
Do we get it back?
We once you approve it, I put it together in the package with your resolution, and I send it to the Department of General Services. They have a division of real estate services that takes care of the sale.
Right.
Now, they will deduct their expenses, appraisal and survey and, you know, and their expenses, which, you know, I don't know, $10,000 or less. But then what's left over comes back to VDOT's big pot, is the way I understand.
Because someone told me we don't get it, and I was going to raise Cain about that.
That's not my, and I think we'll find that in the law book.
All those in favor? Yes, Mr. Cain.
Just the closing of the office does not necessarily give you the declaration that we no longer need the property. Has that been evaluated?
That's my understanding. I talked to the district administrator. He was happy with this.
It's been fairly coordinated with the VDOT management.
Doesn't it say in the last paragraph that it's declared surplus and the provisions of Section 4-509, that means it can be sold?
Yes, sir. I think the last whereas on the first page says we have to, by law, we have to get you to declare it surplus. And I think the next whereas on the second page says we have to get you to approve the conveyance.
And dispose of the property pursuant to the Code of Virginia.
Yes, sir.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much.
Chairman.
Mr. Worley.
Just for clarification, we have gone through all of our facilities. Those are closed and looked at those and sent a report and to the General Services and to the legislature identifying those facilities we think that could be surplus or sold. So this was just one of them. But we coordinated that with all of the districts, and they reviewed each property and gave us their assessment. And we're now, soon we'll be in the process of disposing of more properties.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
my comments come from what I heard earlier, that maybe we've cut back too far with the footprint and with the blueprint. As we look forward, you know, I know one region had a closure of three. And so if we've cut too far, and the evaluation says we've cut too far, and we need that office, then we shouldn't sell it before we make that determination.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we did, any of those properties where we thought was in question, we are leasing the property now, not selling it. So while the property is shut down, we will be leasing it to generate income. But we're not selling those that would be in question.
Okay. Next item, Office of Intermodal Planning and Investment, Mr. Tyre.
Last month I made a presentation explaining where we were going in the future with the Office of Intermodal Planning, and essentially we're going to do corridors of statewide significance studies for the CTV. Fund the Office of Intermodal Planning and fund the PPTA office, and I really don't have anything to add to last month's presentation.
Any discussions? Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Second. Do we have a second?
Second.
Oh, I'm sorry. Cool. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much. Mr. Soyles. Give us some good news.
Good afternoon. I do have good news. We continue to get real good competitive bids. We're still averaging over four bids per project. Prices are rising a little bit. It's what we've seen, and we do have market saturation in a couple of areas. But on the projects I bring before you today, these eight projects at value of about $100 million, they represent good value, and I'm asking for your concurrence.
Want to take them in mass?
I'll move
All those in favor? I'm sorry, we have a motion.
Second.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much. New business, we have this item on the bonds for capital outlay funding for.
Didn't they hand them out? That should be at your desk. It's passed out in the presentation.
Mr. Chairman, I move the approval.
Second.
Do you have any discussion on this? All in favor,
say aye.
All opposed? Any other new business? Okay, with that, that's our last item. I just want to point out to everyone, we will not be meeting in November. The next meeting will be up at the Transportation Conference. This is the first day of the Transportation Conference up in Roanoke. We'll be meeting in the morning, and then in the afternoon the conference will start. So we will not meet until December 7th, right?
December 8th
at 9 o'clock.
December 8th.
At the Hotel Roanoke.
And then the conference is received the days after?
Yes.
That ends on the news about Friday.
Yeah, so the conference is that afternoon, all day on the 9th, and then half a day on the 10th.